said Kennedy McMahon, am an unqualified success.
Now get the guns, the drugs from my generation.
Years ago, I took on every wrestling promoter throughout North America. I kicked every one of their asses. In a court of law, I took on the United States of America, and I kicked her ass. I took on WCW, and it took me a while, but I kicked their asses. Not because I was an asshole, no, no. Ask me, Mr. McMahon, what's your secret? More than any one quality that makes me the successful man that I am, ruthless aggression. So I want to know here tonight, as you stand here on my ring, which one of you has that quality? Who among you has that one single ingredient? Who has enough ruthless aggression?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
North South Podcast Speakeasy Connection. Listen, welcome to another episode of the Ruthlessly Aggressive Podcast. So in the last episode, I mistakenly said that the last episode was episode 5 of this podcast, when actually that is incorrect, but it was too late for me to change that, and I didn't think it was that big of a deal. I got a little confused. Time has no meaning at this point anyway, so this would actually be episode 5 of the Ruthlessly Aggressive Podcast. So this is a big show because this is the first pay-per-view that we are going to be covering since I started this podcast, I guess a couple months ago at this point. And so we will be covering Backlash 02. I've been covering the build-up to this the last few episodes, so it'll be definitely interesting to see how this goes, because it is the first pay-per-view of the brand split. But before I get too much into the actual show that's being covered, let me introduce my guest for this episode. He is a to my knowledge, a podcast newbie. This is his first pod ever, but he's a great guy. He does a lot of stuff, kind of an unsung hero of all the the yearly projects that we do for Place to Be Nation, all the greatest WWE wrestler match, and does a lot of work with that behind the scenes. So we are definitely thankful for that. So kind of, if you haven't seen him on pods, he's definitely around. But my guest on this episode is Mr. Tyler Kelly. How are you doing, Tyler?
I'm doing well, Jacob. Thanks for having me.
And yeah, of course.
You're right. Uh-huh. This is a little weird. Feels a little weird to talk about, but you're right. This is my first time, and I'm very excited and a little nervous, a little unsure, feeling a little tingly. But you know, I think that this is the right time and this is the right situation. I think I've got the right podcast partner. So I think it's to be really special, and I think I'm ready to take this step. And I just hope that you'll be gentle and still want to text with me tomorrow morning.
Yeah, you'll be fine. I'll try and ring general you through this, even though I'm not the Ric Flair podcast or anything, but we'll make it through. I'm sure you'll be fine. So as we said, this show is Backlash 2002. So the standard question, the boilerplate question I always ask everybody when it's the first time on the show is, so obviously I won't go through the whole spiel again, but this is an era that maybe is not, you know, always the most nostalgic for people, yada, yada, yada. So, Tyler, what is your kind of personal background with the Ruthless Aggression era? Were you a fan? For some people, this is a time when they kind of start checking out of it. So what's your background with this whole era as a wrestling fan?
So I am a fan of this era. And, I thought that I would bring kind of a unique perspective to this era, because as any of you that have been on some of the chats and live watches with me know that I'm older than your average PTBN member. So I thought I would have a unique perspective. And then I listened to your last episode, and Sean Kidd kind of stole my old balls gimmick there. So I guess we're going to have to subtitle this one Old Balls 2, Old Balls Are. I don't know. But
Old Balls 2, Electric Boogaloo. There you go.
Electric Boogaloo. Okay. So, and speaking of Electric Boogaloo, I really started kind of watching in the rock and wrestling era because I was growing up and, you know, there was a cartoon that was popular. And so that was kind of popular with a lot of the kids that I went to school with. But I'd watch it, but I wasn't super into the cartoony stuff. My family never forbid it, but they never encouraged it either. So, you know, I'd get a VHS video from the video store, which I know some of the younger PTVN Nation members don't know what the hell that is. And message me sometime, I'll tell you all about it. But it kind of changed for me when WrestleMania 3 came out. And by the time I saw Savage Steamboat, I kind of realized that I was watching things a little differently, and I was a different type of fan than just anybody that was watching the cartoon. So that kind of was what made me know that I'd be the type of fan that would participate in PTBN projects and the like later on down the way. Even though I did get in and out of watching as a fan, I kind of stopped about WrestleMania 6. I was in high school at the time. I got back into it flipping through channels in college when I saw Hogan and the NWO and Crow Sting. And I watched from that point on through probably the end of what you'd consider the ruthlessly aggressive era, whatever time frame that may be. I feel like Jay Campbell's Fighting Spirit of 06 is almost a companion piece to the podcast you're doing, because that's about where I consider the end of this era. But I don't know. I guess
same. I think so too. I think he's kind of, it's a nice what would you call that, like continuity? Because I feel like 06 is about probably still a little transitional, but it's where they're kind of getting out of this era and sort of getting into the full on, you know, Cena era or whatever the next era is called. But
So then I kind of faded away. Life and technology challenges. It was losing DVR battles to 24 and Monday Night Football. It became easier to skip. I'd keep track of what was going on, followed some ROH, would follow some sites. And I think through Scott Keith's side, I eventually found a Place to Be Nation when they started doing podcasts about the time I had the technology to listen to them. And that really got me back in as much as I am back in. Right now, I'm watching nothing modern, but watching more wrestling than ever on the network, older stuff. Like I said, a lot of the PTBN projects have kind of guided my way in that. But specific to the ruthlessly aggressive era, I was 27 for this show. I was kind of, on my own. I kind of worked my way through roommates and all that stuff right after college. So I still didn't have any responsibilities. I wasn't married, didn't have any kids. So I'm a little nostalgic for that point in my life, and I was able to watch a lot at that time. I feel like this is just an era of a lot of missed opportunities, and I think they had a lot of good ideas that they just didn't have the patience to let things play out and develop. I think when it worked best, especially the brand split, you would see a lot of good stuff like you'll see later this year. And then even later, I think even maybe into 07 was when London and Kendrick, I thought, had a lot of good TV matches that they wouldn't have had the time to shine if they'd have been one big conglomerate. One other thing I think came about this time in the era, and at least it did for me, is just kind of this overly snarky attitude of a lot of fans. Definitely myself included, because the internet was still relatively new. And I think that colored the way we looked at some of this, and it's somewhat unfairly criticized. I definitely wish I had embraced more things that were just could have been fun little moments. And this show is definitely a good example of that, I think. I think things were clearly on the decline after the Attitude Era, but there was great in-ring work. But there was a lot of fan cynicism because they just fucked up the invasion. And one thing that fans of like newer fans may not realize is that at this time we felt the wrestling was cynical because it kind of always had been. The promotion would get hot and then it would cool down, and they'd need something else to kind of spike it back up. So rock and wrestling, and then it declined, and then into the Attitude Era, and now it felt like it was in a decline. And in my opinion, we're still kind of waiting for that next rise up. So that was kind of a long way to get around it, but that's my thoughts on the era and why I come to those thoughts, I think.
No, I definitely agree. I think it's something we mentioned on previous episodes on here is the idea that this is, I mean, obviously the internet was around, in the 90s and everything, but not quite to the same level. I think it was a lot more niche in the 90s and people were getting online. But I think I mentioned in the last episode that this is when you really start to get into like things being covered on the internet pretty like heavily. And I agree with what you said, and it's something I find interesting about doing the podcast is that if you go and look at reviews at this time period, because there were guys online like you mentioned Scott Keith. You can look, and Scott Keith at the time was like covering Raw and SmackDown like as it happened, like he was putting up the reviews, I guess, like that day or whatever, that night or the following day. Pretty quick, pretty soon after the shows ended. And a lot of his reviews are pretty harsh, and I'm not trying to dig at Scott Keith, but I'm just, the point, like you said, is that I think a lot of it could be seen as a little cynical at the time. I think a lot of the booking decisions were really judged pretty harshly. And I think sometimes it can kind of cloud people how they view the matches in a vacuum. So it's just, that's one of the things I find interesting about this is seeing, and you've admitted yourself, and you didn't like keep yourself out of, which I thought was some good honesty, that you even said that yourself, when you were a fan at this time, you were an older fan, you had seen a lot of things come and go, and that even yourself, you were a little cynical about some of this stuff. And I think that's one of the interesting things about this, because it's not a widely covered, time span. But so one follow-up I have for you is, so the Attitude Era, like the peak, like 98, 99, that era, were you like locked in at that time? Because it is interesting, because there are fans who kind of grew up in the 80s who really didn't like the Attitude Era stuff as much. Were you into it? Were you locked in with, the big Stone Cold run? Was it your thing, like the Russo Crash TV stuff at the time, or what?
I was locked into it. I'd watch all the TV, and I do feel like the TV was pretty compelling. You often didn't know what the hell was going on, but you couldn't turn yourself away from the stuff in 98 and 99. By the time 2000 was really where it was kind of more my jam, because you had some of that still going on. You still had some pretty compelling storylines, and by then you did have the workers come in with the Radicals and Jericho and on. And Rock and Triple H were getting really good, whereas in 98, 99, they were there, but I don't think it's a hot take to say they weren't as good in ring.
Yeah. So one thing too, since this is the first pay-per-view I cover on here that I want to look into, because since this is a show where I get a little bit more into the minutia, which is kind of a running theme throughout this entire podcast feed, is kind of trying to the deep dives and not just covering the pay-per-views, but the weekly TV, is to see, because like yourself, I found myself watching a lot of older stuff, different promotions, that sort of thing, is to see, I'm interested to see, not just, how each of these individual matches stack up, but after watching and really paying attention to the build of all these Raws and SmackDowns coming as pay-per-view is, how do I see it as an entire product? Like with the build to the TV, like trying to see it as a whole, not just the individual shows, but how does it all come together? How did they pay off the TV that built into this? Is it a satisfying, wrestling product? Like the way they're doing their TV, is it connecting to the pay-per-views? To sort of compare it, because I think it's a good way to compare it to other eras, like the peak Attitude Era or, what have you, is how are they... Is this a satisfying conclusion to what they've been building the past month since the draft? So it's something I'd like to look at and discuss as we get into the show. But all right, anyway, let's get into it. So Backlash 2002. So a few things. So this is the first pay-per-view of the brand split, post-brand split since the draft. This is also the first pay-per-view back in Kansas City since the Owen Hart tragedy 3 years before this. So that is significant. The first time they had been on pay-per-view, I'm not sure, Tyler, you may know, if they had come back here for like Raws and that sort of thing, but I definitely know this is the return for pay-per-view for because this is Kiel, right? Am I correct on that?
No, Kemper.
I'm sorry. Kiel is St. Louis, right?
St. Louis, yes. Sorry. So I don't know if they came back for a Raw or SmackDown, but this was the one and only live wrestling event I've ever attended, actually, which is also a little bit of a strange thing, I think. I didn't have a ton of friends who were into it, but I did attend this show with a high school friend who actually stiffed me on the tickets. I think he called the day or 2 days before, and they were cheap. We were in the nosebleed seats. It wasn't a huge deal. It was just kind of a, okay. As you mentioned, this was the next pay-per-view in Kansas City, in Kemper Arena, which is the same building where Owen Hart tragically lost his life. It was the last pay-per-view in Kansas City until New Year's Revolution 2007. And I looked that up because I had assumed that this would be the last pay-per-view in Kemper Arena because the Sprint Center was built. But according to Wikipedia, that opened in October of 2007. So they did squeeze in one more New Year's Revolution. I've got one quick little story about attending. This is before the show. This was when I had to go down to pick up the tickets, and you know, we still had to do that in person at that time, I guess. And they had, you know, wrestlers signing autographs and whatever. So I'm sure I paid my little money to get the picture and got to meet WWE superstar Chris Benoit. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, that's pretty chilling as you look back on it. I talked to him a little bit. He was injured at this time, as you've covered in the draft.
Yeah.
And so, smarky that I was, I thought, well, you know, there's a reason they got him out here. So, like, oh, yeah, are you gonna be here? And he's like, what? No, I won't be wrestling. And with showing all the charisma he usually showed in promos. But, you know, I thought, well, he's going to do a run-in or something. And now as I think back on it, it kind of gives me chills again. And I don't recall ever finding and throwing away that signed picture. So I just in my head am picturing that it's in some box somewhere. And upon my death, my daughter will clean out my boxes and think, holy shit, Dad was some kind of a murderer worshiper or something. I don't know. I knew
probably
he was
not when you want to. Probably not when you want to frame and put up in the den.
Right.
But that's interesting. So your one show that you've ever been to before or since this show, and it is in the arena where Owen Hart, you know, was tragically killed, and then you met Chris Benoit. So there's quite a quite a bit of circumstances surrounding this. But well, he didn't lie to you because he's not on here. All right. Well, I'll be interested to see, because we'll obviously, so Tyler's been there, so we'll see what, see if we get any. I'm sure you have some anecdotes on the live perspective of what this was like in the building, because it's honestly kind of a historic show. If you think about the main event, I mean, it's a fairly. If you're going to go to one show, I mean, this one does have, you know, it's. I guess it's better than going there. As my buddy Tim calls the some of the. The secondary pay-per-views now, the Touching Cotton, where it's kind of like all the pay-per-views blend together. At least if you went to one secondary show, you know, and this is the one you're going to go to, at least you saw something that is has some historical significance. So you get that.
Yeah. Yep. Definitely.
All right. Another historical thing about the show is that this, I believe, is the last WWF branded pay-per-view. I think by the next pay-per-view, they will be moving into WWE. So another way this show is very transitional, just a ton of transition this era, even down to the name. So all right, let's dive into the show. I think we're ready to go. All right, so we start off with a cool opening package, which is focused on the Triple H and Hulk Hogan feud for the world title. I thought this was a really effective package and really put over the match and the feud, which is the one thing I think is one thing that's been really well done with this feud is it does feel like a big match. It does kind of have this big match feel to it. And they're still really into Hogan as this, like I mentioned on the podcast before, this kind of the old dog, sort of the old veteran coming back for to try and see if he still got it sort of character. Like I keep comparing it to Rocky in the movie Rocky Balboa, where he's kind of, you know, he's real beat up. He can't really go too much anymore, but he's trying to still hang for one more fight. So they're really continuing to put that over in this opening package. But I don't know. I thought this was a good. They're usually very good at this. This has continued even from like the mid 90s. They've been pretty solid at these opening packages for a while at this point. But I really like this one. Did you have any thoughts on the opening, Tyler?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I just put the good opening package. I'm a little disappointed you didn't do your package gimmick
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Wikipedia tells me that the pre-show had Big Show defeating Justin Credible and Steven Richards. And as someone who was there live, I have absolutely no recollection of that. So I'm sure it was a 5-star classic.
Yeah, I didn't look it up. Or that is I'm not going that deep into it. I didn't watch the Sunday Night Heat proceeding. So I guess I'm not deep diving quite enough. So we get introduced to the set. This is an awesome set. It's got the backlash with the actual backlash things that are hanging, that are swinging on the aisle where they're in the entranceway. And they also, I thought it was cool, they kind of had this like LCD banner up at the top of it. And so, like many people, I think many fans of our kind of, I don't know how you'd say that, like, our type of fans are really into these unique sets. It's something that everybody kind of is very nostalgic for that they don't really do anymore outside of, you know, maybe WrestleMania usually gets a unique set, is these old, you know, unique sets for each show. And I really like this one. It fit the theme. And I love that it wasn't just, you know, that it actually has like a physical thing. It wasn't just like a graphic, but actual physical backlash thing swinging. I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that set.
Yeah, it was cool. I always wonder if somebody's going to get smacked by it when they're walking by. But I wonder if that's ever happened.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, somebody's going to jump off of it or something, which would probably would happen if later on down the line if they still had it. But anyway, okay, so our opening match, we have Tajiri facing Billy Kidman, who is the cruiserweight champion at the time, who won it from Tajiri a few weeks before this on SmackDown. And so Kidman is the champion going into this. Tajiri is the heel. He's trying to win his title back. They've been feuding pretty much on TV ever since then. And something that I didn't really think about going into this, but we also have the Fink ring announcing, which I popped for. I was really pleasant. I hadn't really thought about it. I was like, you know, I guess in my mind, I wasn't really sure if he was still doing the pay-per-views at this point, but he was. And I was really excited when I heard the Fink's voice ring announcing.
Oh, but, yeah. He's a class, no doubt.
Yeah. So this is kind of one of the things you see early in the brand split is that even though this is a match that was completely built on SmackDown, we still have JR and King on commentary, and they will be on commentary the entire night. So it's kind of a little bit awkward because we have King and JR doing commentary on even the SmackDown exclusive matches. So it's kind of weird when you heard Cole and Taz kind of following this for an entire month, and all of a sudden we have King and JR. It's a little jarring because in your mind you're like wondering if they're familiar with it. And so obviously there's something that would change down the line that they would kind of switch. But for this first brand split show, I guess they just thought King and JR, the A-team, you want to let them do the whole show. But it is a little bit weird to have them since we haven't really heard them talk about this feud at all. And on the entrances, all King is worried about right now is that Tori is wearing the kimono and that she is covering up her beautiful body. That is King's only real concern in this match so far. So we start off They kind of do some feeling out. We get some nice arm drags. They work in some cool spots with Kidman was bouncing on the top rope and he gets hit by a drop kick. They kind of take it outside. And by that point, that's when Tajiri really starts working it over. And really, he takes the majority of the match, I would say, and really starts controlling it. He has good, brutal offense. He always has those killer kicks. And I think Tajiri, particularly in this match, did a really awesome job of building the heat, especially in a cruiserweight match where I think a lot of times people sort of have this perception that a cruiserweight match is, you know, they just do a bunch of spots. There's no heat to it. They don't sell anything. But I thought this match was like the opposite. I thought this match, they kind of had the best of both worlds with this because they did work in a ton of cool spots. Like I have a list of just cool spot after cool spot. Like Kidman kind of, Tajiri goes to put him in the tarantula and he gets out of it, but then Tajiri works him right back into it. Tajiri goes through the springboard and Kidman drop kicks him. So kind of like the majority, the latter half of the match is all Tajiri pretty much trying to do whatever he can to try and gain some type of advantage. And he does have some good desperation attempts, but Tajiri just keeps on hammering on him. And like I said, I thought they really built a lot of heat. You could feel the crowd really starting to get behind Kidman, which I give a lot of credit to Tajiri and Kidman as well, because, you know, he's selling, he's doing his thing. But I thought Tajiri did a really good job of working him over as the heel to get the crowd behind him, because Kidman is not the hottest act in the world as far as a character. He's a good wrestler, but he's, you know, they even make jokes about on SmackDown that he's not the most over character. He even says it in a promo. But I thought they did a good job of getting the crowd behind him. We get some cool near falls. And it was just, they kept on with that. No matter, Kidman continues to try to kind of gain the advantage back, but Tajiri always has an answer for him. And then eventually Tajiri sort of knows that he, or like he's not getting the upper hand like he wants to, so he resorts to the mist in the end. And I really like the way they work the mist in, because Kidman goes up for a power bomb and Tajiri just spits it right in his face. And it made sense because it's like the ref doesn't really look stupid, because it really is hard to tell. And even when he went to pin him, he kind of covered Kidman's face, so you couldn't really see the mist during the count, which is a really awesome detail. I don't know. I thought this was a really awesome cruiserweight opener. Before I get to my rating, what did you think, Tyler? Give me some of your thoughts before I get into my...
Yeah, I agreed with everything you said. I thought it was great action to start. Tajiri's kicks are always great. Kidman had a nice drop kick to counter the handspring elbow. And like you said, there's lots of different spots you could get to there. And I just think Tajiri has great charisma and great facials. And you mentioned that Kidman has less charisma, didn't really have a character at all. He was a really good worker, but very generic. And then I had crowds chanting for Kidman with the question mark. And so I didn't remember being there live. But I also think this is a match that maybe was a little better when I watched it and could pick up a little more on the facials. Cause like I mentioned, I was there, I was in the nosebleed seats and we were watching on the, you know, the whatever, it wouldn't be a jumbo screen, but the scoreboard, I guess. And I watching that, I was thinking, I didn't like that Kidman kicked out of a couple of Tajiri's kicks, but that's really minor nitpicking. Tajiri winning was the right choice, you know, I thought, because again, he's awesome. And I thought they did a good job of everyone got their shit in, but kind of in a good way. So Kidman misses a shooting star press. Tajiri gets his kicks, the tarantula spot you mentioned. So yeah, I was really impressed there. So
yeah, I think the thing about Tajiri too, that he does such a good job, like I said, is that he's able to do these really cool spots and he has this really dynamic offense, but it's still able to draw heat as a heel. Like he can do this cool stuff, but it's almost like so brutal that he, and like you said, he's so good with the facials and the character work that he doesn't get a face reaction despite doing this kind of really awesome offense, which I think is a testament to him as, you know, as a character. And like I said, I kind of give him the credit. I think he really did a good job of getting Kidman over as the face in the match and kind of getting the crowd behind him, which is awesome, especially in this opener. Well, you know, we're trying to me, this is like a perfect opener. It's a great opener. you know, cruiserweight match, but at the same time, getting the crowd into it and invested emotionally as far as the heel face dynamic. Kind of a little bit surprising, as I thought they were building up Kidman as the face in the match. He was getting such good face heat that maybe he would have gone over, but I kind of expect that this is, you know, this will probably continue given that Tajiri kind of screwed him over and, you know, the whole Tori situation, which we'll kind of get to after in a second. But yeah, I thought this was a really awesome opener. Like I said, sort of the best of both worlds. Really cool spot you'd expect from two guys like this, like in the cruiserweight division, but also it wasn't just a spot fest. So I actually went 3 3/4 on this. I thought this was a great match.
Okay. I was a little lower. I was at 3. So, but I thought it was a really good match too. So.
Yeah, I have a feeling I'm probably high. I think if I would go look up reviews of this match, I'm probably, you know, on the upper end. But I don't know. I just thought it was, yeah, I just thought it was really awesome. I don't know. I thought they had the crowd eating out of the palm of their hand, which is awesome. But, okay.
They definitely did. Mm-hmm. Did you want to talk about the Tori stuff? Because I did have some notes. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so the whole Tori thing, I haven't mentioned it, which is also, I think, a testament to the match that I wasn't really too caught up in the Tori stuff as I was watching it, that they didn't let that, like, completely, you know, dominate the match. So during the match, so Tyler, what did you notice during the match? I kind of mostly put notes about the post-match with Tori, but do you have anything during the match that you want to mention?
I actually had something during their entrances. The crowd is chanting for Tori, and JR points out, well, why is Tori staying with Tajiri? And that may have been kind of almost a slip, mm-hmm. you know, like you said, that they weren't covering SmackDown. Because when he said that, I did watch the TV leading up to this, the 1 week beforehand that you and Sean talked about in the last episode. Mm-hmm. But I was like, well, that's a good question. Why the hell is she staying with him? And I don't know the answer to that. I don't recall. So maybe you do, having watched all of it. Maybe there is a good idea.
I don't think they've really covered as far as like a concrete reason, like he has something on her. I feel like they're just trying to play almost like it's kind of dark, but like an abusive boyfriend. And there's a lot of stereotyping in it. You know, he's kind of playing how common of a stereotype, but like after the match, after all the matches, he always berates her for some reason and screams in Japanese, which it's kind of weird because they almost try to make it seem like it's more heelish because he's speaking in Japanese. But it almost seems like not really like any concrete reason besides like he's very controlling and almost like she's afraid of him, I guess, kind of like an abusive boyfriend kind of thing, like I said, which is dark, but that's my best guess. But I haven't heard them say anything as far as, like, you know, specific, like, reasons why, you know?
Yeah. I had down that he made some good points in his post-match promo. I think they should have done something to cover, you know, to not be as dark. Say, you know why Tori is probably staying with Tajiri? Just because of the Japanese buzzsaw in his pants. I mean, that's why. Yeah. Not for anything dark.
He's packing heat.
Yep, that's right. So,
yeah, anyway. He's packing heat. Yeah, that would have been. It sounds like something they would have done, honestly. Hey, if this was about 2 years earlier, you know, if this was 1999, that's probably where they would have went with it, is that Tajiri's got a magnum dong, and that's why she's.
exactly.
But, yeah, that's but you, like you said, you could kind of see it coming with the Tori and Kidman stuff. Like you said, with King asking why she would be with him, which is the question everybody asks. And that's why I feel like this is not done. So this is something I had noticed throughout the show, and I'll get into it as we go. But this was the first, right from the start, is like King. To me, King did not contribute much to this match at all. And I feel like he's feels really out of place in this sort of match, this kind of, you know, a match that's more athletic, more about the spots, more about the athleticism. JR is fine. You know, JR can switch into this mode. He's very good at it. But I felt King, and this is something we'll see throughout the night, is I just thought he was useless, because all he wanted to talk about was the Tori stuff, which, you know, like on SmackDown, Taz, to me, has done a much better job, because he kind of mixes in the kind of goofy horn dog comments, but then he'll also kind of actually give comments about what's going on in the match. So I feel like he's sort of taking what King does, but making it better. And so, like, I kind of wish we would have had Taz and Cole in this match, because I think Taz would have done a much better job of getting over, you know, the work in the match, if that makes any sense. I don't know if you had any thoughts on the commentary, but.
No, I mean, just the overall, I agree with your thoughts on King. He's pretty worthless by this point, and, you know, continues on for however much longer. He continues on decades, but whatever.
Yeah.
It feels like.
Yeah, like,
It feels a little jarring because up until December, you know, we had Heyman, and when they made that shift, oh, that was a rough one. To go from Heyman being on commentary to King, that was a bitter pill to swallow. So.
Yeah, and I think, as we'll see on this show and a few other matches, that their entire... the tone of the shows is changing. You know, they still have some of the kind of like Attitude Era sort of stuff, but they're moving into focusing a little bit more on the athleticism, about the wrestling, you know, and I don't think that is King's strong suit, or he never really lets himself get into it. It's very rare that he does. And so I think he starts to feel a little bit out of place with some of these matches, because it's not really his wheelhouse, or at least not anything we see from him often. So, but I have more thoughts on him later as we continue. So, all right, let's keep moving. We have Bradshaw, who catches over Farouk backstage, and Bradshaw is coming out for his match because obviously the APA has just broken up, but they have to, you know, dab it up because they haven't seen each other for a little while, I guess. But so we have Scott Hall versus Bradshaw. This stems from the NWO, the angle where they trashed the APA's former office and they assaulted Kane and Bradshaw came to the rescue. Hasn't been like an amazing build or anything, but I thought it's pretty decent. A pretty decent build. And the only thing I didn't like about so in the entrances, Bradshaw obviously still has all the APA gear. I think he even still has the APA music. And so Bradshaw is almost like was a highlight of these last few episodes of Raw. Like he's really Bill well, he kind of got the rub from Austin. So to me, I feel like this is, you know, a feature for him and trying to establish him as a singles guy. So I wished at this point, I understand when they first broke up, you know, he needs time to figure it out. But I thought this would have been the perfect moment to kind of establish him with something new. Like on the pay-per-view, he comes with new tights, maybe some new music. But instead, he kind of just comes out in the same old sort of APA stuff. I would have really liked if he would have, you know, started to establish himself as his own guy. Any thoughts on that, Tyler?
Yeah, I agree. His look, he looked just like he looked in the APA, and that jarred me. I didn't even remember that was the case, you know? So I'm kind of picturing JBL, and I'm like, oh, wow, he's, you know, he is straight acolyte almost, you know, hasn't changed his look then. And, so yeah, I definitely agree with that, and I watched the TV, excuse me, a little bit beforehand, and I had remembered Bradshaw's first singles run as just kind of a fart bomb that it just didn't really work at all. But I agree with what you and Sean said in the last episode, where that he was pretty good. He was a lot better brawler than I really expected him to be. So. But yeah, I wish he would have freshened up his look or done something to differentiate himself a little bit better, and that might have led to a little more success that way.
Yeah, and so the NWO, or what's left of the NWO, which is Hall and X-Pac, come out. And so X-Pac is kind of refusing to leave. He's still wearing the Kane mask. And so Farouk comes out, and we get a big APA chant. And I get why they want to have Farouk come out. Like, the crowd's going to be into it. The APA are kind of a beloved team. They're still over at this point. And so I get why you want to have Farouk come out and get the pop. But I feel like it would have been a little bit better if they have Farouk come out, he takes X-Pac out, and then we leave it at that. Like, I feel like it's just, along with the tights and the along with his gear and his music and the whole presentation, I feel like he also needs to distance himself from Farouk. I get you want to get the pop. You want to see, you know, the people are going to be excited to see, you know, the APA and Farouk helping him out. But he needs to establish himself as a singles guy. And I don't think constantly calling back to him being the APA is doing him any favors with that. So I kind of wish that would have been kept to more of a minimum. But all right, so we go into the match. And so this was a pretty basic match. So I felt like when Bradshaw, you know, when Bradshaw's on offense, obviously his power stuff, he has nice intensity. But the only bad part was is that I felt like Hall had no chance of matching Bradshaw's intensity of this match or the way he was working. Because as I've covered before, a few episodes on as we've done this so far, is that Hall has not looked great, like physically in the ring. His offense is super limited and lame, and it looks really soft. He does punches. I think this match sounds like something that could be cool on paper, but if you actually watch it, it's really disappointing. JR even at one point said this bowling shoe ugly, so I feel like he even knows it's not looking great. But like I said before, like he goes to do like Bradshaw goes to do a DDT, and like he can't even Hall can't even like go down smooth on the DDT. He almost has to like stagger himself to the ground. So he just looks really rough physically. And to me, it just kind of makes the match feel really disjointed because Bradshaw's, his strength is that he's so intense. He's this intense brawler. He beats the shit out of people. And then you have Hall, who in his prime could do that, but he's so slow and lame at this point, and he just can't really do much of anything. So to me, it just completely kind of submarines the match. He hits the clothesline. So Bradshaw hits the clothesline from hell, but X-Pac sneaks Hall's foot on the rope to kind of save him with that. So Farouk is beating up X-Pac, and then Hall hits the low blow and then rolls up for the win on Bradshaw. So Hall takes the win by nefarious means. Okay, what was your thoughts of, on this, Tyler, before I get into my grade?
Okay, so first I started out, and they, I said, we've got to put an end to this NWO poison, which is some of the dumbest shit I've ever heard. Bringing the angle to bring them in made no damn sense, and you could almost tell from the first promo that this was not going to work, before you even saw any of them. And by the time Hogan was gone, it was very apparent. I actually had, when Farouk came out, they could have made it a tag to, just to get X-Pac in there. You're completely right. And that would be counterproductive to making Bradshaw a successful singles wrestler. I think I was looking through the eyes of watching this 18 years later, knowing I don't want to see Scott Hall wrestle at this time in his life. And I'd been there and I knew that this was not a good match. So I'll get into the grades, and it was maybe even better than I thought. But yeah, I had Hall looks like shit, bloated, in bad shape. I actually think that his style may not have meshed with Bradshaw's in his best days, because at least he was often, you know, wouldn't match the intensity because he, you know, he's too cool for school. He's flipping his toothpick and whatever, which when he was good, you know, I loved and we all loved, but that wouldn't really match up with an intense brawl to me. I had down that Hall goes outside one point, and it looked, just felt like he stood with Farouk right behind him for like 10 minutes, you know, before he turned around to get clocked. I thought he had a nice clothesline from hell. I had Scott Hall had no damn business winning this. I know he was the bigger star. I may have even wanted him to win at the time because I was a fan of his in the NWO and WCW. But he was bad here, and even, you know, by this point, it was kind of getting, you could kind of tell it, even in 2002, like, this is getting really rough, and I thought the roll-up was super cheap.
Yeah, it was, he's cooked, but, the finish was lame, he's cooked. Bradshaw has looked really good since putting up with the APA. I hate to, like, I don't want to say, well, this is what I would have done the match, but to me, it's almost like, and I know Hall will be gone really soon, But even if he wouldn't be, I don't see the point of having him win this. I kind of felt like Bradshaw should just came out and crushed him pretty much and moved on. You know, come out, have Farouk take out, you know, X-Pac so you get the nice APA pop. They kind of go to the back, then let Bradshaw pretty much destroy Hall, kind of get his revenge. And then don't even continue the feud. Just let him, you know, crush Hall, almost like semi-squash him. And I know it's kind of like, well, Hall's a name guy, but, you know, he's got nothing left in the tank. And I thought the crowd would have loved it. And I think it would have been a good feature and continued to build Bradshaw. But that is not what happened. And this was the match. It was not good. I went a star and a half, which to me may even be generous.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking that. I went two, and as we were talking through it, I'm dropping it down to your star and a half. So,
yeah, and it's I think I had to, because I almost went to give them the benefit of the doubt, like you said, but it's like I just couldn't when, because the match is just, it's not good. I don't know.
And I did feel like Bradshaw had some good work. I feel like they did this quite a bit at this time. They just were like, well, this is our 1, 2, 3, 4th top baby face from the top, and our 1, 2, 3, 4th top heel, whatever, and they'd match him up. And that was just kind of where this fell. But it wasn't a good matchup, and it was all Scott Hall at this time, you know, and it's no coincidence he was gone shortly after.
Yeah, and so the NWO just needs to be gone. Let X-Pac go singles, and let's just move on, because it's a complete mess. Okay, continue on. So we head backstage. Vince barges in the Flair's office, and we get Arn Anderson looking hot as always. He's got his nice shirt that looks right out of 1991. He says, Vince says that he likes Flair's style, and he's getting used to being the boss, and that Rick is starting to feel the heat. So basically the whole crux of this is Vince pretty much saying, like, well, now you're starting to see what it's like to be in my shoes. You can't please anybody. You're always in a rock and a hard place. Nobody's ever going to... you know, nobody's ever going to be satisfied, basically comparing Flair to him. But then Flair says that Vince can't relate to him, and he's not going to be like Vince, and refuses to shake his hands, which, I mean, I guess if I'm invested in the storyline of like the authority figures or the GMs, which I really haven't been, this kind of makes sense. But I wasn't really, I'm not that invested in it. So I was not too big on this. It kind of just felt, you know, like it was just there for me. I don't know how you felt, Tyler.
Yeah, I had some of the same thoughts you did. I had the AA sighting, and I hadn't thought of it until I heard you say the shirt was right out of 1991. But since Arn Anderson looked like he was about 40 when he was 21 and looks about the same right now, I think time is a flat circle in AA's world. So it might have been 1991 in 2002. I'm not sure. So I'm going to workshop that a little bit, but
yeah, I'll never judge him. I'll never judge him because I love him.
Exactly. So, I had, I think, you know, Vince said, how about that NWO? And I pretty sure I responded to my TV, fuck that NWO. and I did kind of pop because Flair actually said, well, I'll never be Vince McMahon. And he, you know, he meant it very like, I will never be like you. And Vince said, maybe not, but you can try. And I don't know, that popped. Just a little bit.
Yeah, that is a good Vince line. That's a good Vince line. But yeah, they're obviously trying to continue to build a Rick, and we'll see it later when he's the ref. But kind of, I don't know.
I will have thoughts on that. I've got
thoughts. Yeah, not building him as a heel necessarily, but kind of trying to build, like, what is his character as a GM and kind of how he's been struggling with it, I guess, is the point. Is, but like I said, I'm not very invested in it, so it didn't hit very well with me, but... Anyway, all right, let's move on. So we have our women's title match, which is going to be Trish versus Jazz. Jazz, obviously, the champion, which, as I mentioned on the last show, is kind of a weird build because most of the build has really centered on the feud between Trish and Molly as Molly kind of turns heel. But Jazz has been around. She was on commentary, even though she didn't talk on on Raw. So it has been a little bit of a weird build because we haven't seen a ton of interaction between Trish and Jazz. And kind of go with that, as soon as Trish comes out in her entrance, Molly heads out and says that Trish is a cheater, hits her in the face, throws her into the stairs. So before the match even starts, we already kind of have Trish as kind of sort of as the face that's at a disadvantage, that's going in already, you know, with an early deficit, so to speak. And so Jazz heads out. She throws Trish in the ring. We get a really kind of cringy comment where JR says that Jazz is like Mike Tyson, and King says that Tyson's better looking. So, you know, that's King's going to King, I guess. That's sort of his thing. But so the match is basically majority of it is just Jazz hitting a ton of power spots, which all looked really good. I thought Jazz looked awesome in this match. She had a sick power bomb. She reverses. Trish goes for like the Bulldog or the Satisfaction or whatever, and she kind of reverses that. She locks in. And so as she's doing all that, Trish gets some nice desperation spots and really fights despite being beat up and obviously being kind of overpowered in this match. She keeps on trying to fight out, but eventually Jazz locks in the Boston Crab and gets Trish to tap. I thought this was a really solid match. It wasn't anything amazing or anything, but like I said, I kind of thought it was good for what it was meant to do, because I think it's continuing to build sort of sympathy and face heat for Trish, but at the same time was a solid match for what it was. I liked Molly coming out and beating her up in the beginning because it continues sort of the heat between them, and so we're kind of starting to get sort of this three-way sort of thing going on in the women's division. Take that as you will. But I thought Trish fought valiantly, but she couldn't come over the raw power, which is a simple, but I thought effective enough story for this short match. Yeah, so I thought this was quick and solid. I went 2 stars.
Okay. So I had that Trish got a nice pop, and I talked a little bit about, had some notes on Molly's promo when she comes out and says, we don't want our WWF champion, women's champion, to flaunt her body and in Kansas City, yeah. And I'm sure 2002, Tyler was one of the ones saying that, indeed, we do want that at this particular point in time. And so I did have, I was a little confused when they showed Trish trying to grab the tights, Molly's tights on the roll-up, but it looked to me like Molly was wearing a singlet. It didn't look like that's what they were going for, but it just didn't look like it hit to me. So I don't know. That seemed odd to me. And I did like the Molly early beatdown. I felt like at this point in time, Trish was still moving a bit awkwardly. She had some cool moves by now, the headstand, head scissors. But she did really know how to play a character with facial expressions and all the like, you know, in match. So you could tell she got it. So it was just a matter of time before things really kind of caught. So I didn't like it quite as much as you did. I had this one at 1.5, but you know, I didn't think it was bad. It was just short. So then I thought that Jazz also made some excellent points in her promo. So, which yeah. was again that not speaking at all given. So.
Yeah, which yeah, I agree with you, Trish. She's obviously not where she would be yet, but she's definitely developing, and I think she can do enough to. You know, she's not going in these short matches, and she kind of carries herself. And I think Jazz is a really good – I kind of like what they have going on in the women's division. I mean, obviously it's not going to be, you know, it's not vast or super complicated. But as far as these three being sort of like your core, I think it's a pretty solid core for the women's division for this point in time, because you have Trish as kind of like your top face. And kind of like what I said about Tajiri doing a good job with Kidman, kind of getting him over as a face. I thought Jazz did a really good job in this match because she, I thought, looked really good as far as like her work, like her power, like all her power spots look good. And having Trish kind of like, even though she loses, she kind of fights through him and tries to kind of overcome it. I thought it really helped, you know, get the crowd behind Trish. And so I just think they have I'm interested to see where it goes, because I think they have a solid little, you know, small core of these three women. And I like to see what they do that all kind of have like a unique role. And so I'm interested to see where they go with it. I think they have a nice little thing going on with these three right now. I mean, it could be a lot worse for sure.
Yeah.
All right. So we will continue. We have, okay, so we get a recap of the stuff that's been going between, I guess you could say, Brock and the Hardys, but really, I finally, they focus more on the incidents between Lita and Paul Heyman, where Heyman has been stealing and sniffing her panties. King defends Heyman for stealing her panties. He says, I've fondled a thing or two. King, you know, King's gonna king, as he does. Well, talking about fondling women's underwear. Yeah,
I had that down. I fondled a thong or two in my day, but seeing Heyman do it was sleazy. I had once said he may as well have added, I paid my hard-earned money to fondle those thongs, and that cheapskate thinks he can do it for free. So that's what I expected was the rest of King's monologue.
It really is interesting, given King's, things in his, real life, that this is the character that they choose to go through. But, I guess they say it's turned up to 11. But, it's interesting, given some of the things that have gone on through King's life, that, that's the character he portrays on TV. But anyway, so we get actually a backstage promo with Heyman, and he's just kind of hyping up Brock, getting him pumped up for the match. I thought here, Brock's sort of demeanor, he's kind of seething sort of and gritting his teeth. And I thought like here he looks a little, he's obviously going to get a lot better and he's going to sort of fix this. But he looked a little goofy to me, like a little hokey in his facial expressions during this promo. Like he looks hyped up, but he looks a little bit goofy, kind of looks like a goon. I mean, obviously he's going to get it and work it out, but that was just one of the few critiques I have of him so far, is that I just thought his mannerism seemed a little hokey, like a little bit like over exaggerated. But maybe that's just me. I don't know if you.
No, I did notice that. I had his eyes were bugging out, looking like a freak.
Yeah, he looked a little bit too cartoonish for me, I guess, for how good he's been established. Because one thing, and I think it gets established in this match, is that he's not just some big stiff, like some goofball, big guy who can't do anything. But let's get into the match. So we have Jeff, in my notes, I don't know what happened. It must be like autocorrect, but my notes say Jeff Harry, which is, it's like, who's that guy that screwed up his name and called him Jeff Harvey? Mike Adamley. Yeah. Called him Jeff Harvey. I have Jeff Harry. Jeff Hardy, who was going to be facing Brock, it was really supposed to be Matt Hardy, but due to Brock F5ing Matt on the ramp on Raw, he is out, so Jeff is going to have to take his place. So they start off, and it is immediately clear, like I mentioned a second ago, that Brock, because this is our first real match from Brock, definitely his first pay-per-view match, his first real match, is that he's not a stiff. Like his offense, he's not just a big guy who can't move. His offense is really crisp. He also, for the few spots that Jeff does get in, he bumps and sells pretty well. So this is a lot of Brock domination. Jeff gets a few hope spots. He even gets a kind of a semi near fall on the Swanton. But this is really a showcase for Brock, like pretty damn close to a squash almost, with Jeff just getting a few sort of hope spots. He does the rolling power bombs. But by the end of it, he actually doesn't win with the pin. Brock wins by ref stoppage, which I thought is a nice, was a nice little touch to just get him over as a monster. Ref stoppage is always kind of an iffy sort of thing, but I thought it worked in this situation. So this match is kind of more of a debut for Brock than any kind of like anything you consider like a real substantial match. But I thought Jeff played his role well, bumping around for Brock and getting him over. Solid kid. It's not, only so good it could be for what it was supposed to do. But for what it did, I thought it was fine. So I went 2 stars. What's your thoughts on this one, Tyler?
Okay. I agree that Brock mm-hmm. just great. And he looked more than just as big stiff. I feel like it was squash like, but there was more to it, I felt. Like,
yeah, for sure.
He tried to start really fast, which I really liked, because since it's personal, it's always a pet peeve that a lot of people have talked about, here's this blood feud, let's start with a tie-up. And he didn't do that. He tried to brawl, he tried to use high-flying moves, but Brock just showed his power. He caught Jeff coming over the top on the outside and did Suplex City V1. And you mentioned Brock selling a few times. He got rammed to the post and he sold the shoulder like he should just for a minute, you know, because his debut, he's got to look good. But it did show that he wasn't just a squash. It wasn't just Goldberg in 1998 version 2. Hardy did get a brief flurry, which did pop the crowd. Heyman had a line that said, "This is your fault, Lita," that I could have done without. But and then there was a second flurry when Brock just kind of looked away for some odd reason that I didn't get, and he got hit with the twisting moonsault running up the ropes, and then later Hardy hit the Swanton that you mentioned, and Lesnar kicks out. Brock hits the F5 double power bomb, and then Teddy Peanut Head Long stops the match, and it was Teddy Long, wasn't it?
I think so. I wasn't paying that. I don't remember well, but it sounds.
And I'm watching a lot of WCW from like 1990, so Jim Ross calls him that a lot. So that's where it comes from. So that's embedded in my brain. So, but I thought Rock was like $1 million, like the future all-time great that I think he is, which I know that's somewhat divisive because. I agree that I don't necessarily care to see a match of his from 2020 on, but he's had some great performances, and you could definitely see that start of that here. He showed all the tools, from the power to the wrestling ability, and he didn't sell a lot, but you saw that he could sell. So, and I just thought it was just done to perfection. Jeff was the perfect opponent, and Brock nailed it and knocked it out of the park. So I went 3 stars for it, that's probably too high from a match perspective, but I just thought it did such a great job of achieving what the match wanted to do. Yeah.
So the whole package, if you will.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
No, I agree for sure. It definitely accomplished what it was. And I like that they put this on pay-per-view, that even though it is kind of, like you said, it's not a pure squash. It's more than that, but it kind of has the, what I would say is like the same goal as a squash in a way. Is to just kind of get him over and feature him, but he showed up in the moment, and it's, you kind of already start to see why they're so high on him and why he's getting such a, he's getting a push, but they are, I feel like they kind of, I'm interested to see how this goes too with Brock, because I always feel like sort of the perception is that he was just shot straight to the moon, but they are building him, you know, it's not like he just walked in and immediately like got a title shot. They're building him up. Like to me, this is almost sort of an old school way of booking somebody. You know, they kind of like, he's not really even wrestling on TV. He's just beating people up. And then his first match on pay-per-view is sort of like a, just a showcase match. It's kind of an old school sort of way of building up a new guy that you really want to get over, you know?
Yeah.
Which and I enjoy. I like it.
Yeah. And I think it was effective. This was really the start of a pretty hot period. You know, being there live, this was where you're like starting to think, yeah, things are getting pretty damn good. So, and it continues here for a while.
Yeah. So, yep. Brock looked great. Okay, we continue. Next match, pretty big, good looking match on paper. We have Kurt Angle versus Edge. So this is stemming from they've been feuding on SmackDown. Probably the most notable. Segment of their feud was when Edge gets Kurt to read the look at the pictures on the back. It's got a bunch of stuff like an arrow pointing up at his face saying he's a dork and then he has no testicles and all that sort of stuff. And so since then, they've kind of been, you know, interfering in each other's stuff, kind of standard but solid build. And I'm really interested. So I know I keep – this is like a broken record stuff I want to pay attention to. But it's like Edge because this – part of this whole angle with Edge is that it's to elevate him, is putting him in a feud with Kurt, who's a high-profile guy. And I'm really interested in tracking him as, honestly, like, Edge's whole prime to me is sort of, like, singles Edge is not something I'm well-versed on. And I know he's kind of a controversial guy, polarizing, I guess maybe is a better word, that... you know, some people love him. Some people think he's vastly overrated, you know. So I'm really interested to see how, you know, Edge builds through these shows. But anyway, so we start with Edge kind of takes an early lead, I would say. He kind of meets Kurt at every move. And so Kurt lures him out the ring, and that's how he starts to take over and really starts building the heat and taking the momentum. They trade some near falls. Angle falls awkwardly. Edge kind of hits him with like a German, and he like gets crushed on his head. I don't know if he knows. And that's a pretty sort of famous spot from this match, is Angle getting dropped on his head. I don't know if you remembered that one even before you watched it this time, Tyler. Him getting dropped on his head.
Angle dropped on his head from a German. Let's see if I have.
Yes. Yeah. I just know it's something people always mention about this match. It's like one of the spots people kind of remember, is him just falling awkward on his head. But and so we get a crossbody to the outside by Edge, and pretty much they sort of just kind of go back and forth a lot for the rest of the match. Is the majority of the rest of the match. Edge does get hit with the Angle Slam, which he kicks out of, which is a pretty big spot. I think some would argue maybe he shouldn't have kicked out of it, but I guess they're trying to get over Edge, you know, to push him a little bit. I really like the spot where Edge gets the roll up out of the ankle lock. And then for some reason, and I wasn't a huge fan of this, Angle goes for the chair. I guess you could argue he's getting desperate, but I wasn't really sure if they really built why he would be desperate at this point in the match. But he goes out and gets a chair. He does a spot where he kind of ping pongs the chair off the ropes into his own face. And so I think that he gets a near fall off of that. So he does kick out of the chair shot. And then Edge goes for the spear. And I actually really like this finish where Angle kind of dodges the spear and then wins with the Angle Slam. That was a really cool spot. So this match, I'm interested to see how you feel. And I know this is a match that's pretty highly rated, I find. Like, it's considered sort of a great match. And I definitely think it's a good match, or even a very good match. But I have to say I was a little disappointed on this watch. Like, it wasn't quite to where I feel like the reputation of it is that I've kind of seen before. And that I thought all their spots looked pretty good. But in a certain way, it sort of felt like everything was crisp and they kind of had some good spots and reversals, but it sort of just felt like them exchanging moves for me, if that makes any sense. Like, I felt like there was not much, like, it didn't build much to anything, I find. Like, it was high action, high speed, you know, a lot of energy, but I just didn't feel like it built to anything to really put it to that level of, like, what I would consider great. Like, to me, it didn't build enough heat or momentum to get past something that I would, anything, like, past good or very good. So I'm interested to see. I don't know. Maybe I'm being picky. What are your thoughts on this one, Tyler? I'm very interested in what your thoughts are on this match.
Okay, so now this one is the one that I remember just being the match of the night. This is when I did turn to my friend and said, that was a hell of a match. And I kind of knew that he wasn't necessarily the work great guy that I was. So I like it. That was the one, though. That was really the one that stood out live. And I loved it, rewatching it as well. So I had a note that Ken said he was getting into the "You Suck" chant, which was new, which is hard to believe. Is it that came about from this feud, correct?
Yeah, I think so. If people were doing it, it wasn't, it wasn't as over until this feud, you know. Like, is it possible there were, like, chants of "You Suck" at Kurt? But as far as, like, the entire crowd in unison screaming "You Suck," yeah, I feel like it started here. Yeah. And I didn't mention it, but, yeah, when he comes out for this, it's, like, nuclear, which is awesome. Yeah.
And Angle was, he was my jam, if that's what the kids say these days. I don't know, because, as mentioned, I am old balls. I'm not relevant to the kids. But I just thought he was one of the, he got wrestling from the in-ring to the character, just a total package, better than almost anybody quickly, and he just kept getting better. So as far as Edge, I have pretty similar thoughts on him as you do. I wasn't watching a lot during what would probably be considered his peak, but I think he could make a case that this might be his best year between what's to come. Now, he's paired with a lot of really good people, and I feel like this kind of his coming out party. So I don't know. I've always felt he's good, or he's okay. He's good even, but he's, I feel like the WWE tries to make him into this all-time great, and I'm not sure I'm there. So,
yeah.
But I thought this match had just pretty nonstop action. I had down that I always liked the Education DDT. I always thought that looked kind of good. Felt like Edge climbed to the top, and I had no idea what he was going to do other than to be up there for the pop-up superplex. But then about two notes later, Edge did a flying crossbody off the top, so maybe I was wrong on that. Just had a note on Angle's his suplexes just all over the place, and he took a holy shit bump over the top from a backdrop. I didn't like the chair shot bouncing back to hit Angle in the face, because that's just a really cartoony spot. Now, Kurt does it about as good as anybody could. It didn't look completely ridiculous, but it still made him look a bit dumb. But like you, I was happy it wasn't the finish.
Yeah, it seemed a little out of place to me in this, for what they were going for in this match, which is basically, like, to me, what they were trying to go over is like two athletes going, you know, high speed, high energy. I didn't see the chair. The only way I could see the chair is, I feel like you need to build up like that Angle's desperate, but I never really got that, you know, because when he goes, you know, there was never, he's not at a point where he's emptied out the entire tank, I found. I don't know, it's just weird. I didn't feel like they had built up that he would have been desperate enough, you know?
Yeah. I was like you. I really liked the finish. So I had down that Angle had a kick counter to the spear. I thought he kicked him.
Yeah. He does kick him. I think he kicks him and then hits the Angle Slam. Am I right? Or does he run with the kick? Yeah.
No, he hits this kick that was just, you know, perfectly timed, and then falls right into the Angle Slam. And I always like that type of finish. You can do something and then hit your finisher, which, and we'll see that here coming up as well. So I thought this match fucked. I mean, I really liked it. I thought it's coming out party. It's my favorite live. Got the crowd going, and to me held up on a rewatch, or at least to the level that I thought it did. Now it didn't make my GWWE top 100. It was never in contention for it, but I thought it was really good, and I had it at 4 stars. So I guess that's where the discussion would be. That's probably where I would call a low great match or high very good match. That you may consider it different. I don't know.
Yeah, so I went 3.25 on it, which, again, I kind of knew that this would be low, but it's like I didn't want to just go higher than what I thought, because I guess, and like you said, I'm a huge Angle guy too, and I know the criticism of him, or the main critique of Angle, is that, is sort of what I'm saying here, is that, you know, it's just full force, but not enough to it. But I find a lot of other Angle matches, there is more to it. Like, I don't really buy into that narrative about Angle. But for some reason, I don't know, something about this one just didn't click. But, like, I feel like what we've been, you know, what we've been saying as we've been discussing it is all these awesome spots, which they are all awesome spots. But I didn't feel like there was anything taking all that and pushing it to the next level for me, which I know sounds like a kind of vague, but I don't know how else to say it. But I won't keep going on about it, but it just didn't hit quite what it does for a lot of people. And I don't know why. I just feel like it didn't. It just felt like them hitting a bunch of awesome moves, but not really building to anything, which is obviously still awesome, but it just didn't hit that next level for me. But totally understand.
And I will freely admit that if I was going to overrate anything based on being there live, it would be this match. So I probably am. I'm comfortable with that. So I'm sticking to my guns on 4. So.
Yeah, I'm not going to judge you. Yeah. And it definitely doesn't seem like this is going to be the
I said you can judge me for many things, Jacob, and this is going to be low on the list of things you could judge me for. So
Yeah, no worries.
In other news, these rankings are brought to you by Jameson. So they didn't pay anything, but they are a heavy influencer. So
No, you're good. So another thing is that it definitely does not seem like the end of the feud. This definitely seems like it's going to continue. I mean, we kind of know it's going to continue, but, you know, even if we pretended like we didn't know, it definitely seems like a chapter one sort of deal. So, all right. Carrying on, we have Jericho, who is not booked on this show. He doesn't have a match, so he is pissed off. He comes out to ring for a promo, complains about not being on the show after headlining Mania. He said it hurts his feelings. He's better than everyone. And says he must not be welcome, so he's going to leave. I thought it was a really good promo, actually. It just seemed really a little out of place on the show. And it seems weird that he's not doesn't have a match on the show. I mean, I'm not sure what you do with him, and I won't get into all, like, you know, who would he face and all that. But it's just weird because he is, you know, I mean, he's kind of right. He did headline WrestleMania, so it is weird he doesn't have a match here. Like I said, it's a really good promo. It's like typical, you know, a little bit right, but also kind of delusional and annoying heel Jericho, and he's really good at it. But I just didn't know. I didn't know if it really fit on the show on pay-per-view. It seems more like a normal TV promo, sort of like kind of smushed into this pay-per-view.
Yeah, I thought it was a really good promo. I was right with him. Why the hell isn't he on this show? And your point about it being a good, based in reality, yet just enough delusion promo to make him still a heel. And those are the best heel characters and the best heel promos. I mean, he is really hitting that right during this time frame, I feel like. I think that he was really hurt by the fact that the title match is a babyface match. So that does kind of leave him out in the cold. And I went through this mental exercise. Well, who could he have faced? And there was just nothing. I came up with, you know, several really shitty ideas. One that I thought could have been a possibility is that he could have been added to the Austin Taker match and just make it a three-way. I don't normally like three-ways, but we'll talk about that match and see if that might have made a difference in that. You could still keep the booking the same, because I think what they wanted to avoid was putting Jericho right back in the mix. You didn't want to give the title right back to him. So, I mean, and that I think he was just, you know, it was like musical chairs, and he was kind of the odd man out. So.
Yeah, it's like, I guess you could put him with somebody that he would have just beat handily, but then I guess is that any better than the promo? I don't really know. I guess it accomplishes the same sort of thing, but yeah, he's not. We'll see him, but he's not wrestling on the show. Again, a good promo, but just felt a little odd in the show. So we head backstage really quickly, and Taker kind of confronts Flair, sort of trying to intimidate him. There really wasn't much to it. It is what it is. I didn't have much to say about it. It just sort of happened. So we continue on. We have our big Intercontinental title match with RVD versus a returning Eddie. This is Eddie's first pay-per-view match since returning in the last few weeks after a stint on the indies that we've kind of talked about on previous episodes. I thought both guys coming out both looked like they were in killer shape. Like, Eddie's completely jacked. RVD looks great. And so obviously this feud was Eddie on his return basically continuously interfered in all of RVD's matches, pretty much made his life hell and sort of forced him to give him the title shot. And like I mentioned before, it's a very simple feud, but a very well-built feud, and with two guys that that can pull it off and that you're looking forward to the match. Before we get into it, any thoughts on this feud, Tyler? I thought it was really well done coming into this. I was hyped for this match.
No, I totally agree. This was the one going into the show that you were really looking forward to. And, you know, as I talked to people standing in line to wait for our tickets or whatever, this was the one. They're like, this could steal the show, you know. There was a lot of smarky bitching about things, but this was the one people were excited about. And I do think the build was just really good. Like you say, it was simple, which makes it easier to, you know, easy to understand. Frog splash. Although, as JR mentioned, he credits D'Lo Brown with the first frog splash.
Yeah.
Small chuckle out of.
Yeah, I think King asked someone commentary, well, who did the frog splash? Goes, well, I think it was D'Lo Brown, which I was excited to get a D'Lo Brown name drop in the middle of this.
Right.
But yeah, it's been awesome. And I think Eddie's looked killer since he's come back. He looks completely locked in. Like, he just really seems focused. Like, his character, and probably him as a person also. And so, and like I mentioned before on the last show, this to me is just like the ideal, like IC title sort of feud. These, this just screams like the, you know, the, what the IC title is all about, you know, two guys that are kind of on the undercard, but workhorses that you can expect a great match of. So I think that's exactly what you want from this title. So getting into the match, so we start with some back and forth. Like you'd expect from these guys, we get some cool reversals, both of them with some cool dynamic offense. And then they kind of move into the next segment of the match is kind of Eddie on top. And he starts working over RVD's back with a ton of suplex, a lot of different suplex variations, which is really cool. We got a really cool reversal. There's a cool reversal of a superplex where RVD kind of nails Eddie on the ropes, almost like a stun gun sort of looking thing, which was really awesome. Eddie puts him in a really cool surfboard. Like, it's almost like he had a sort of like he was going for the surfboard, but then he just locked in a headlock, which was kind of like continuing to work the back, which, like I said, is sort of the whole second segment of this was Eddie on top starting to work over the back, which was really awesome. It was really focused. He had a lot of variation. And they also hit like a sick sunset flip with like, I think JR even commented on commentary, like, there's a killer impact when they hit it. Like, I think it was Eddie got hit with it. He just slammed into the mat and it just made this like vicious thud, which was really awesome. So I definitely really like the intensity. And so almost kind of what seems sort of out of nowhere, we get a ref bump and then Eddie goes out to, he gets the belt and then he hits a neck breaker on the title. And then he hits the frog splash for the win. And so I thought the ending was a little bit abrupt and I thought they were really working into something really great in the first part, because it kind of started with the feeling out and then Eddie kind of on top is the kind of working heel a little bit and working over RVD's back was really awesome. But then it kind of just seemed a little abrupt that he just kind of went, they hit the ref bump, Eddie goes for the finish. And I know you kind of want to have, you know, Eddie is sort of the heel in this a little bit, and so you want to get a little heat that way. But I thought it cut it off a little bit. Like, it never got quite to that next gear. It's like I was waiting for that next part of the match where they're really going to, like, amp it up and go into, like, a closing sequence. But it kind of got cut off when Eddie went for the belt. So I thought it was a good match. And you definitely get a sense that this is the first of a series. The way, and I think that's kind of the reason for the, you know, for the finish and everything is, you know, leave a little bit on a table, which makes perfect sense. But it's just could be seen as a little disappointing if you're really expecting this to be a classic. But I guess they're going for, you know, if there's a next match, they'll amp it up then. So the finish seems a little abrupt, but I did. Yeah. So I think it cutting off kind of held it back from being anything great. So I kind of went the same rating as I went on, Edge and Angle. I went 3.25 on this one. Again, still a really awesome, good match. It just, I feel like it kind of cut off before we got into that next part that maybe would have pushed it, you know, a little bit further. So what did you think, Tyler?
Yeah, I think that your analysis is spot on. I thought there was just really good aggression from Eddie to start out, and RVD would kind of counter with his quickness. And Eddie just remained savage the whole time. So yes. I made the same note about RVD countering that superplex. He kind of jumped outside and did like a stun gun clotheslining Eddie on the top rope is the way I had it down. And then when Eddie blocked the second Rolling Thunder with his knees, from that point, it's just savage kicks, backbreakers, attacking the back. And I did kind of make a note that it seemed like the crowd and so I'll take the blame for this, I guess, that we were a little quiet for what I thought was a really good match. I would have thought would have been a little more engaged. But I had that Eddie had a gory special countered by an RVD sunset flip. So I don't know if that was the sunset flip you were talking about or.
Yeah, I think so. A little bit. Yeah.
Okay. As I had that Eddie did a really swank sunset flip power bomb from the top rope that I thought was really impressive. And Eddie was doing some suplexes, and King said something to the effect that that was taking a page out of RVD's old book. So I got 3 question marks after that because I have no idea what he was talking about on that. So I'm, I'm not quite sure, but that happens with King from time to time. So, so I agree with you about the finish. I liked that at least they did the Nick nice right on the belt and then wins with the front splash. At least it wasn't complete bullshit. You know, it was a little bit of bullshit and then he hits his finisher. So I like that a whole lot better than just a completely tainted win. It's still heelish, but at least he got to hit his Nick Breaker and then his finish right on the belt, or hit the Nick Breaker right on the belt and then his finish. So I was flip-flopping back and forth between 3.25 and 3.5 stars on this as well. So we're right aligned, but you can go ahead and put me down for 3.25.
Yeah, same thing here. It was just in that sort of good, very good range, but not really above that for me. But like you said, I think him getting the belt, I mean, it kind of makes, it's like I said earlier, it could be seen as disappointing, but it didn't disappoint me the whole thing, because it's obvious that, I mean, at least seems obvious to me now. I don't know exactly where we go with this, but it seemed like sort of a chapter one of a feud. And so I kind of was like, okay, that's fine. I kind of get it. And I guess him going for the belt is just like, you know, he is sort of working in a way, like you said, that he's really brutal. He's really focused. And maybe he's just like, look, I'm just going to get this belt and end this now because I want this title, you know? So I guess that kind of makes sense. It just doesn't make for, you know, all-time classic match by ending it like that. But, you know, it makes sense, I guess, for the feud. So you mentioned King. I forgot to mention the Angle Edge match. And I think it shows up, I think you mentioned it a second ago, in these matches that are more, you know, athletic, where really the crux of the match is like you have two great athletes going at it, really working a really awesome match. I mean, think about all these spots we keep naming that these guys are doing. You know, this is not like 1999 where the mid-card, you know, guys come out, there's a bunch of brawling, the match is 5 minutes. Like, you're getting guys getting like decent chunks of time and really doing, you know, some real, you know, quote-unquote wrestling, if you will. And I feel like King is kind of lost in this. Like, I thought in the Angle, I didn't mention it then, but in an Angle Edge match, I feel like he really almost like actively hurt the match because he doesn't have much to add when the whole idea is that you have two sort of stud athletes going at it. I feel like he seems a little bit lost. And like I mentioned earlier, I feel like Taz, from what we've seen on SmackDown, is sort of a little bit better at it because he still does his sort of pseudo heel, makes corny jokes and that sort of thing. But he's a lot better at focusing in on the athleticism and sort of getting into the minutiae of, you know, the match itself, where I feel like King is very rarely will do that. And so when you get these matches, he seems a little bit lost. Like JR, I think, is like right in his wheelhouse. He's really good because he can kind of focus on, you know, what's going on in the ring while at the same time getting over the story. So I feel like JR is really awesome on these. But King, to me, just seems a little bit lost, like on this match, too. Like you said, he just seems like he doesn't know what to say when he can't, you know, make some kind of goofy joke. He seems a little bit lost at times. I don't know if you noticed the same thing, but this was a running theme on the show for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing that you'd mentioned, you talked about Taz, and I thought Taz was really good at this time. So,
yes.
I mean, like, yeah, he was kind of a breath of fresh air, so... And yeah, King's not going to be what you want to put over the athleticism of the athletes and the legitimacy of the product. So I also thought it was interesting when you mentioned it felt like the first chapter, and really that's kind of a theme throughout this show. So yes. At least the last few matches, that definitely happened. And that makes perfect sense, right? Because you're just coming off the draft where you've mixed things up, you've shuffled the deck, whatever. And this is the first time they'd done that, so, you know, there was a little bit of things felt fresh, but there was a lot of this must continue. So, you know, had things been a little more definitive, had there been a little more stakes to some of these matches, I think this show would be considered a really good show. Or maybe it's really good now, it could have been really, really good. Yeah. You know, I think it could have been just a little better than it is going to wind up being.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. It's kind of what I, yeah, we'll get to it when we get to the wrap up, the overall, but I know exactly, absolutely what you're saying. Because not only the draft, too, but they're coming off of Mania, which is normally sort of when they reset things. And then the draft is like, at this point, is like a hard reset. So, yeah, it makes sense. I have no issue with it. It's just, you know, you're not going to get, you know, they're kind of holding back a little bit. So it's, you're not going to get these all-time classic matches most likely when guys are kind of holding a little bit back, which is fine. I'm not, it doesn't bother me, but, you know. Okay, whew, this next one. So we have Undertaker versus Stone Cold with Ric Flair as a referee for the number one contender spot for the world title. This feud has been given a ton of time on TV, like a good, easily the most dominant feud on Raw that takes up huge chunks of the show, all things considered, if you consider the time the guy's in the ring, the promos. A lot of times this is the promo that opens Raw and, you know, lasts about 20 minutes. So this is a very heavily built match between Taker and Austin. The build has been sort of up and down. It hasn't been great, but it hasn't been, you know, a dumpster fire either. Flair comes out with these red shoes. I don't know if you caught this, but JR went like historian on us and said that maybe the red shoes were homage to Johnny Red Shoes Duggan, I think he said, who apparently I looked that. It up.
I yeah, did not he, look up who he was, so I had no idea who he was at that
point. Apparently he was, I forget now, I looked it up, but I didn't write it down, but apparently he was like some famous ref, like in some territory, I want to say, maybe, I want to say it was like San Francisco or one of those territories, but like he was just a ref, and like apparently he was a famous just for being a ref, and he always wore these red shoes, and I guess just his mannerisms and stuff like made him famous as a ref, so who knows. I mean, I could see Flair throwing that as a reference. I mean, Flair's, you know, he's been around for a while. So I could see him throwing an homage in there, which I thought was cool enough. I think it's undeniable. So this does, at least with the entrances and at the beginning, has a ton of crowd heat. I mean, did you get the same sort of impression? I mean, you were there. Did it seem kind of hot?
Yeah.
Did it feel like a big match going in?
Yes. So first off, I had that Flair's red boots look like he took them off the Wicked Witch of the East, which I believe would have won the house fell on because the West was the evil one. So, and there's probably people out there thinking that, well, the show was in Kansas City. Maybe that was intentional, but just for the record, Kemper Arena is in Kansas City, Missouri, which is also where the Super Bowl champion Chiefs play and the Royals play. And I'm from Missouri, but I do live on the Kansas side now. But back to your question. Yeah, there was a huge pop for Austin. There was a bunch of what chants after that, which I had forgotten that this was just the absolute height of that. And it is annoying as hell. But yeah, Austin had nuclear heat. That's how we start out anyway. I don't really know why Flair needed to be the refs here. I mean, I know the storyline they're going with, but I just, it was falling flat with me, to say the least.
Yeah, so let's there's a lot to get through this. So, okay, the match itself. So we get a very kind of old school start, a lot of feeling out, kind of like not a lot of big spots, almost like some goofy stuff to start a little bit with Austin kind of messing with Taker a little bit. There's a lot of stalling. And like you said, so this is already with the stalling kind of taking a little bit of wind out the crowd, even with the onset. And I felt like, you know, this is a very long match. I feel like in the early going with the stalling, it was like, okay, they kind of knew they were in for like a 30-minute match, and they're killing a little bit of time even from the beginning. Like, let's kill the first, you know, 5 minutes or whatever, just kind of stalling and not doing too much. So Austin eventually starts working over Taker a little bit until Taker turns it with a big boot, and we get our first count from Flair, and immediately his count is like terrible. It's like one of the worst counts I've ever seen. Like, he makes Nick Patrick look like, you know, amazing. Is it's like so stiff and awkward. It's almost like he like plants his elbow into the mat and just kind of lets his hand fall, and then like when it's a near fall, he's obviously just like damn near stops when he knows he's going for a three count, like he doesn't want to mess up, because he just like, he won't even really come down on the two. He's just waiting for him to kick out. And oh man, it's real bad. I know you mentioned it kind of on the onset. You have any thoughts?
Yeah, I had Flair counts pins gingerly. So like you said, it just looks like you could put an egg underneath his count and he might not break it. So, and at this point, I had said that Austin does push-ups and flips the bird, which may be the high spot of the match, at least to this point. But not for a spoiler. I'm not going to get a whole lot more positive.
Yeah, it was a little. It was a little weird because it's kind of not, you know, his normal. Like, you know, Austin style is usually, you know, coming guns blazing, you know, wild brawling to start, and instead it's like completely. It's almost like early Macho Man kind of, you know, going out the ring and all this sort of stuff, which is, it was odd. And like I said, it feels like they're just killing time, and so so they kind of do that for a while, and. They started doing some brawling, which was fine. Like they kind of went out the ring a little bit, and they do kind of just standard brawling you expect from these two, which was fine. I thought that's when the match sort of picked up a little bit, but then they go back in and then it just kind of grinds down to a halt. Like whenever they stop the brawling and Taker starts working in like a ton of rest holes, it's just like, that's when I felt like the crowd, completely just kind of faded, like we're gone. They were just silent, I felt. Did you notice that, Tyler? I don't know.
Yes, I absolutely did. You're following right along with my notes. I had the pre-long brawl outside. And you're right, that's probably the better portion of the match, but they're not doing much. They're punching, kicking, and ramming heads into whatever they can find. And of note, that's better on TV than it is for a live crowd. Because at least a portion of it can't see that area very well. If you're close, you wouldn't be able to see the opposite side. I was way up high, as I've mentioned several times. So you could see what they were doing, but they're, you know, it's just not as compelling. And it is about this time, and I hope I'm not getting ahead of you, but where the NWO comes out and we get.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. And I had it marked at 14 minutes in and not much going on, and the crowd is dying. So that's probably about where you're at.
Yeah. And so we're like halfway through. and like you said, so the NWO, it's around this time the NWO comes out, but they just do nothing. They just kind of come out and watch. They don't have any, they do absolutely nothing in the match. So it's like just there for nothing. It's like, so they're just there hanging out. Taker does a ton of rest holes, kind of cutting off any sort of momentum they may have been building. And like you said, even mentioned, the brawling really seemed uninspired. Same thing here. It wasn't really working the holds or anything. It just seemed like something to do to kill time. Then we get our first ref bump of Flair, and then Austin hits the stunner, which obviously, Flair can't count because he got bumped. And then so we get a low blow, and then Taker hits a choke slam for, I put a near fall, but that's the thing too. It's like, it's not only like Flair's count is like, okay, it looks bad, you know, but I think obviously this match has a lot of other issues, but it's almost like they can't even do a near fall because of Flair's count. Like you can't even build the match with the near falls because it's like Flair's counting. There's no way you could build any suspense because it's almost like he knows what the finish is. And if it's not going to be the finish, he's just not even going to sell like the three that he's going down for three at all. He'll go like one, two, and then completely stall and go in slow motion, waiting for somebody to kick out, which really hurts them trying to get it's just another thing working against the match, trying to build any momentum, you know?
And JR and King keep putting over that Flair is an inexperienced ref. So that's part of the story, but that's just a shitty story. You mentioned the ref bump. He has to do a ref bump like he's just a regular ref, like a pussy, instead of the 16-time world champ. I mean, these are really
deep
bumps and everything. He's awful on near falls. I mean, there's not much going for this match at this
time. Yeah, you're right. He's like selling it like he's Earl Hebner. Like he gets bumped and he's like knocked out. Like, yeah, I mean, You're right. I mean, he is older here, but I mean, he's gonna fucking wrestle after this, back. Like later. But yeah. So the chokeslam gets a near fall, then Taker goes for the chair. We get another ref bump, which kind of gives Austin time to kick out after the chair shot. And so the finish after, I mean, by this point, we're at about 27 minutes in this match. So it's really, really long. Austin's holding the chair and Taker boots the chair into him. And so he goes down. He's very near the ropes. And so his foot is on the ropes. Flair blatantly, you can see Flair look. It's like he looks at his foot on the ropes and then starts counting. It's so bad. And then he counts Taker for the win. And so they're trying to get like that Flair screwed up. And like you mentioned with the JR comment, I feel like that was an instance where like, you know, like when JR does the bowling shoe ugly thing, it's almost his code where he's like, look, I don't want to bury the match, but you know, it's like halfway he's trying to sell that as part of the story. And it's like almost like he's speaking code to us. Like, look, I know Flair looks like shit as the ref, like, you know. He's almost like pointing it out to us, like, oh yeah, he's not experienced. Yep, he's not good. And King is just not helping him. He's like, look at Flair. But the thing is, like, King gets caught up on like that he's counting too slow or fast or whatever, which is honestly not even really the problem. Like, and no. It's like, why is he even here? Like I said it during the build, but it's like the whole story is that they Taker and Austin are both pissed because he's interfering too much. And so he decides to put himself as ref. Like, what's the point? I don't understand. It's like he's trying to create a problem for himself. Like, what was he accomplishing as the ref? It's not like, you know, either one of them. It's not like part of the bill was that they were, like, planning to cheat or something. It's like I really don't know why he had to insert himself. It really – I guess maybe their point is to start to get the crowd to go against Flair, but it's effective. But anyway, this is a very long – yeah, what you got, Tyler?
Mm-hmm. But Flair's not turning heel, so why would they want the crowd to go against him? So yeah, I mean, he
looks incompetent, is really what it is. You know, he just looks incompetent and like we'll get into it, but kind of as a GM too. Okay, so let's give our thoughts on the match, and then we'll kind of discuss. You know. So obviously this is very long and meandering. They really never built any heat. The crowd, I mean, especially because the crowd is hot because these are two, you know, superstars. Like, besides the brawling, everything was super plotting. Flair was not a good ref. I thought Austin brought intensity in spots, but just really disappointing, especially for how long it dragged on. I went a star and a half, and honestly, I think that might be generous. It may be worse just going by the rule of how long it was for eating up this much time. I just don't think they should have been given this much time. But we'll talk about a little bit more about the feud and all that after. But what was your rating on this, Tyler?
Okay, so yeah, I hated this match. I felt like this killed the show at this point for me. Anyway, if nothing else, because it was just way the fuck too long. We talked about how bad Flair was, but one point we hadn't talked about was he looked like a pussy for just letting him to do whatever they wanted to do with the chair, because he was watching them most of the time. Yep. Like an absolute moron for not seeing the rope. I hated it live. It didn't get much better on the watch. And it is mostly because of the link, but it felt like it really stop the momentum because you went Edge angle, then RVD Eddie, and those are two really good matches. Afterwards, Austin loses, and then he stuns Taker and drinks beer after the loss anyway. It was, I think he was maybe the best of the three, but that's really damning with faint praise because you could tell Austin was going through some of this stuff here. He just didn't feel and look like Austin normally looks like. The NWO did nothing but stand around like absolute morons. And then, do you want to include the post-match where Coach talks to Flair?
Yeah, that's what I was getting into. So we're both in agreement that this was not good. kind of bad. So after, but even before Coach shows, talks to Flair, we get, so Flair walks back down the ramp, goes backstage. Austin stuns Taker after the match and does the whole beer drinking thing, which to me felt extremely forced. Like, it almost reminded me of the, like the Hogan Must Pose thing. It was kind of like Austin has to drink the beer. Like, he's got to get the heat back. He's got to stun Taker. It felt very forced and out of place. And I mean, I'm assuming that the crowd popped for it, I think, but because it's kind of just what you do,
I think,
but it seemed very forced. Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't give you my rating. I went a half star, and that's, and maybe that's low, but that's probably because this is the mirror image of the Eddie Angle theory, where that was the best match on the show. This was one that just, I just couldn't hardly take it. So, and again, the length of it is what's going to say, you know, you cut it in half and, you know, I'd probably bump it up to two. I don't know.
And it's real like emblematic of that. This is sort of a transitional time because like we've mentioned, we have kind of all these, you know, fast, and I'm not saying they have to go in there and, you know, do the spots that RVD and Eddie are doing, but it didn't need to have a half an hour of stuff that was mostly plotting, you know? And it just, it's a real contrast between this match and the stuff that we saw earlier that was, you know, that sort of stuff. It really is, you know, and I think even Austin, if you were to ask him, I mean, he's usually pretty straight up about this sort of stuff. I think he'd probably say he didn't remember the match first. He'd be like, I don't know, that was not my, you know, that was not a good time for me. But I think he would probably agree that it wasn't the greatest. It's just, he just seems, I don't know what they do for him at this point. Because it's like, I don't know if they know how to put him in something that's not the main event. You know, I don't know if they know how to fit him into the show right now, and they don't know what to do with him. And he's obviously not very happy, as we'll see in the coming months. But it just seemed very out of place. And like you said, it kind of drags the show down.
This was kind of the start of the things that would come that would lead to some of his problems. And you're right. He just doesn't fit anywhere except as the alpha male, kicking ass, drinking beer, you know, there's just, it's hard to evolve that character, I think. And they just were never able to do it much after the heel run, which was, had some good and some bad there. So,
I think he still has some intensity, you know, I think he still has some of the fire a little bit, not quite, you know, like I said on the last show, it's like him, you sort of feel like he's mailing it in, and at least on the Raws and everything with the promos and all, it's like, and even the matches he's worked, you know, on TV, it's like even him sort of mailing it in is still pretty good, but this just, but let's not linger on it too much longer. Yeah. So like you said, we get Coach, catches up, runs after Flair backstage to ask him about it. So it was honestly so bad, the finish, that I almost thought what they were trying to do is like Flair's almost like, without making it too obvious, trying to screw Stone Cold. Like, that's how bad the finish was, until I got to this part where they show him, he looks at the footage and realizes he made a mistake, and then he gives the oh shit. Even though, like we said, if you watch the match, you obviously saw it in the match. So even before going into this little interview, I almost thought there was a chance that it was going to be like that he screwed Austin on purpose, sort of, but apparently not. Apparently he's just incompetent. And like you said, he just looks dumb because first of all, he shoehorned himself into the match when he really didn't need to be there. Like, it's unclear what his motivation was for even wanting to be in the match. And then he completely screws up. Like, so he just looks like, I don't know. He looks really weak, I think.
So Jacob, watching it live, I thought that, because I was like, what the hell is going on? I can, you know, I'm looking way down and I can clearly see his foot's on the rope and he's looking right at it. And so like, okay. So then they show this footage and, you know, Flair just says, oh shit. And I'm like, that's what I heard. But I turned to my buddy. I'm like, wait, what did he say? He's like, he said, oh shit. I'm like, okay, well, they don't usually say that even on a pay-per-view. I don't know why you would bother with profanity for this shit. Because oh shit was my take on the match too. But yeah, I was expecting something more like, oh yeah, no, I never saw anything, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I thought that maybe was where they were going, because otherwise it just doesn't make any sense at all to me. Or it was so poorly executed that, yeah, just didn't work.
Yeah, it's just, it's not been, the Flair as a GM stuff has not been great so far. He is not, you know, because I just think it's not, the highlights for me so far is when he kind of gets out of the, like, straight-laced GM role and sort of goes nature boy, like the few moments when he kind of cracks and gets intense and throws the coat off have been, like, the highlights for me, because when he's just this sort of quiet, I don't know. He just seems like this kind of dumpy, incompetent guy in a position that's like out of his, you know, that he's in over his head, which is not the most endearing. And, you know, he's kind of a face. So it's like, I'm not really sure why I'm behind him, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I've heard different interviews from, they wouldn't be shoot interviews, but they're in documentaries or whatever, where like Sean and Triple H are talking about how he'd really lost his confidence at this time. And I don't know how much that's complete bullshit that they're putting out there, but I assume quite a bit. But when you look at something like this, that thought just struck me, and he doesn't seem like the confident nature that we're watching in these greatest WCW matches of all time. You know, that's not the same guy right at this moment in time.
So, yeah, that's a good point. I've heard them say that. And yeah, you're right. It definitely shows here. He does not look confident at all, but... Okay, let's go. So our next match, before we go into the main event, we actually have the tag title match sort of put in the cool-off spot here, which is a little bit of a bummer. But as we talked about, the tag division is not necessarily booming, or it's almost doesn't even exist, because most of our tag teams, our marquee tag teams, have been broken up. So they're sort of rebuilding it. So we get Billy and Chuck with Rico. They're our champs against sort of the recently thrown together team of Maven and Al Snow, sort of working the mentor student sort of tag team gimmick, which I think is fine. I mean, at least they have some connection. They're not just completely thrown together, which I think is a decent enough, you know, reason for them to team up. So this match, they start by working Maven over. We get some fun scenes. I thought this was kind of like maybe the highlight of the match is when Al Snow and Billy are in there, and they had there was a pretty cool sequence where they Al Snow did sort of that thing where he gets thrown to the corner, but he kind of hits the brakes before and comes back, which was cool. So we get to a point, Maven, I thought, hit some nice moves. He looked pretty solid. And, so we kind of just do that for a few minutes until Snow, Rico kind of starts interfering. Snow chases him off, which distracts the ref. And then Maven eats a killer kick and gets the win for Billy and Chuck. So this was just sort of like, for me, this was just solid, a solid heel tag title defense with, you know, a distraction finish to let the Billy and Chuck train keep rolling. But I thought it was decent enough for what it was. You know, nothing great, nothing bad. Didn't overstay its welcome, so I went 2 stars on this one.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. I think that it's, you know, saying that it's just kind of solid to the point is pretty good. I thought it really had pretty good action to start. I feel like Maven is just so generic. And I know that I've heard people say that Al Snow has some great stuff. I just haven't seen it. And I think he had some good stuff in Smoky Mountain Wrestling, which I've got on my list, but I haven't made it that far in there. Maven sort of feels like he won Tough Enough because he just didn't cause anybody any shit. He was just kind of a good little employee, but not necessarily because he was especially talented or charismatic. And I don't know. Were you watching any of Tough Enough when it was going on, Jacob?
I feel like I remember watching the first season pretty regularly. But after that, no. And like you said, I think it's like they try. It's like his whole gimmick is that he won Tough Enough, and it's like he could never really, he never really breaks out of that. It's so he's typecast as that, and he can never really get out of it since he was the first winner. You know.
Yeah. And he does have some nice moves. I thought his drop kick was nice. And then he hit a really nice cross body. But those are kind of the generic moves too. Like anyone who can jump a little bit can do those moves and look nice. I mean, his dropkick is maybe next level. Now that's an A minus, yeah, at least. But you know, just isn't real big. Isn't real. It doesn't have great work rate. Isn't great on the mic. Just kind of there. Which is just fine. I'm in this spot, you know. And I thought everybody really worked hard. I thought the super kick from Chuck worked good. So, I went 2.25. And I was surprised that I liked it that much, actually. I was really ready to shit all over this, but everybody worked hard. Perfectly fine placeholder for 1 month feud or whatever. I don't know how long Maven and Al Snow are as contenders, but I suspect it's not very much longer.
Yeah, I kind of wish they would keep them around just because they have no, like, I'm not even saying make them like contenders, but I think they have a decent enough, gimmick for their team, like the student mentor thing. And I think they could work well as just sort of a, kind of like a role-playing tag team, sort of like, not that they're necessarily going to win the title, but I mean, you just need that in a tag division. You need a team that can go in there and give you a decent match, put the heel over, or put whoever over, and, you know, they don't have to be world beaters or anything. They just have to have, you know, I think it would be a decent role. I don't know where they're going to go with it. What are your thoughts? Do you like Billy and Chuck? I really enjoy them so far from what I've seen. They're very old school to me in that, you know, like an old school heel team with, you know, they are a team. They're not just two guys thrown together. They have kind of, you know, matching gear, and that they have a good Rico is kind of a old school style heel manager who's like always interfering and, you know, cheating to get them to win. So I kind of like their whole deal they have going on right now. I just think they need a good foil.
Yeah. So I do like the matching tights, some sort of a gimmick. I like teams that just look like they belong together. I mean, it's always a pet peeve of mine to have just two thrown together guys, or even a regular team, but their name is just, you know, name of Billy Joe and Joey Bob, you know.
I
don't like that, you know. So from that perspective, I don't know what to say about the gimmick, and I don't know how I could relate 2002 to, you know, obviously with 2020 eyes, it's a little cringeworthy.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem from what I've seen so far that the aspect of it that you're kind of mentioning, they haven't really worked that in a ton yet. Yeah, I think it's more to come.
Yeah, I think so.
And so from what I've seen so far, I have a feeling that it's going to get a little sketchy later on. But so far, they haven't really pushed that aspect of it much, which I'm sure they're going to get there. But so far, I like them. I enjoy seeing them, you know. Okay.
So I think if you talk about them like in the annals of WWE tag team history, they're not great. They didn't finish super high on my list or on the general list. But if you talk about them as part of the show on the roster at this time, I think they're fine. I think they're good or they're better than a lot of other stuff. You know, they're not just jobs or anything. So, yeah.
All right, so we head to our big main event, world title match between Hulk Hogan and Triple H. So a lot of build to this match. Crowd is obviously nuclear for Hulk Hogan. That is the whole reason why he's getting this title shot pretty much, is that since WrestleMania 18, the crowd has been hot for him and kind of resurrected Hulkamania. I really love JR here. Like, almost how I was shitting on King earlier, it's like the opposite for JR. I think JR has really done an awesome job on this show because I think he can do both. Like, whenever it's athletic, he does a pretty good job of that. And when it's trying to put over like a story, like he does here, like as Hogan's coming out, he completely outlines like what Hogan's motivation is in this feud. Like, can he do it one more time? Can he, you know, can he bring back Hulkamania one more time? So I thought JR did an awesome job of just putting over like why Hogan's even in this match. Thought it had a really big fight feel. Triple H, of course, gets his, you know, really long water spitting entrance thing, but it definitely felt like a big match. Both of them were absurdly fucking tan. but yeah, so just on the pre-match stuff, I thought it was the whole package, if you will, was really good. I mean, I said I won't rehash it too much, but the build to this has been a little awkward just on the position they were in, but I think they've made the best of it, and it definitely it seems like a hot match, and the crowd seems hot. Did it? What was it like? Let me ask, since you were there, what did it? What was the feeling, you know, when it was time for the main event?
100%, Jacob. So, you know, Hogan gets a great pop. People are chanting for him. I feel like the crowd was kind of waiting for this. So, and this is where I mentioned before, I felt like there was times I was a little too smarky for my own good. And this is the example of that. And I regret it a little bit. But I didn't really want Hogan to win. And there are reasons I can justify that. I thought he was too old, and he'd shown that in WCW now. Since he'd been back in the WWE, he's really been re-energized. But, you know, I was just too smarky to enjoy that moment. But I also wanted babyface Triple H to work. I think at this point, we were starting to see some mounting evidence that it probably wasn't going to work. And he wasn't quite the same guy from 2000 to 2001 on any kind of a regular basis. Although I think in this match, he does some great stuff at all. You know, we'll talk about as we go on. But yeah, the crowd was just nuts for it. Flash bulbs are going off. You can see that on the TV. Just, you know, flash bulbs are going off. And I see in my notes that I think I have some pictures somewhere, but I didn't go find them. They weren't digital, so they're in some box somewhere, probably with a picture of Chris Benoit with a heart around it that I would destroy if I could ever find. But but yeah, the crowd was ready to go for this one.
Yeah, I thought it was, so they mentioned on commentary, this like blew my mind, is I think Joe said this, that Hogan is in his late 40s, which like blew my mind because he looks like he's like 63 years old.
I like, can't. I've always wondered if they used that up, or if that's the case, he would have been bald quite early in life. Yeah. So and I know that's always a taboo thing to ever say he was bald, which blows my mind. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it makes sense because it puts him as, you know, I don't want to sit here and calculate math, but, you know, his late 40s, so they put him, you know, by the 90s, he's in his 30s. I guess that makes sense. But I guess like you mentioned with Arn, he's kind of a guy that like he's looked old for like 50 years or whatever. So just like the way he looks with his whole deal. But anyway, let's get into that. Just struck me, like when he said he's late 40s, I'm like, oh my God, he's in his late 40s here. He looks, but
yeah, he looks so rough.
So we start with the test of strength, kind of doing sort of a Hogan Warrior callback, and that is pretty much your whole first part of the match, which is fine and sort of expected with Hogan, especially in this era. So they kind of do a lot of like test of strength stuff, all of those sort of spots. Then at one point they go outside, and to me this is like maybe the most memorable spot of the match. But Hogan takes a suplex on the out on the outside of the ring, which is like killer. And one thing about him I found is that Hogan in this sort of in this framework is that he's really limited. Obviously, like in the early part of the match, he doesn't do a whole lot of stuff. But the thing is because he's so limited that when he pulls out something like this, like a suplex out on the mat, it feels so meaningful because you're just like, oh shit, he's pulling out the, you know, like he doesn't have to do that and everything. And it's just, it sort of makes it hit more than, you know, if Edge and Angle hit a suplex outside, you're just like, oh, but you kind of move on. Where when Hogan hits you, like, oh damn, Hogan's taking a suplex to the outside, you know, it kind of hits a little harder, which I guess is sort of like taking his, you know, limits. And, you know, I think it helps put over the, when he does, you know, take a little bit of a risk on things. What'd you think of the suplex outside?
Right. No, well, that's the grand old debate, right? On do you do less and make it mean more, or do you, you know, just go balls to the wall all the time? That's the criticism that some have on, you know, for Kurt Angle, which I don't agree with that, but you know, well, some of the older matches I watch, I see how some people are better at building things up to make it mean more. And I agree.
Yeah, I think it's just I think it's just sort of a silver lining to him being as limited as he is at this point. You know, it's just it is one positive that just kind of comes out of maybe a negative of him not being able to do too much, is that, you know, when he does go for something, it kind of sticks with you. But after that, so the next portion, so we get Triple H starts working the knee. He just starts clipping the knee, going after Hogan's leg. So Hogan kind of almost does a semi Hulk up, but then Triple H sort of cuts him off and continues to work the leg. And I sort of really like this spot in the match, and I'll get to it kind of when we wrap up the whole match. But I almost wish they would have done this a little bit more in the match. But so at this point, so Jericho comes out, pulls the ref, nails Hogan with a chair. And so Triple H could kind of go for the cover, but he still faced Triple H, and this kind of continues to establish that he cleans out Jericho. So he tosses Jericho. And so at this point, then we get the real Hulk up. He comes, misses the leg drop. Triple H hits the pedigree, but then Taker comes in and interferes and stops the count. He nails Triple H. We get the leg drop. Hogan wins to a huge pop. And Hulkamania officially is back completely because Hogan is now the champion. So let's talk about the run-ins. What did you think of the run-ins with Jericho and Taker, Tyler? Did that hurt the match for you? What'd you think?
It did, and it pissed me off. Not so much because there were running. I don't think that we couldn't have had interference, but to me, this interference just didn't make much sense. And I made note of that. I'm like, okay, so Jericho's interfering to stop Hogan from winning. And I guess he's been cutting some promos against Hogan, but he just got done feuding with Triple H. So I didn't quite understand his logic there. And then when Undertaker came out, I put down, what the fuck is he doing out here? Does he just want Hogan? Maybe he feels like he's older and an easier target, but that was never established anyway that I was aware of anyway. So I just didn't understand what he was trying to do out there. So I wondered, were they trying to set up a four-way, but they just painted themselves in the corner with Undertaker as a number one contender. And I get that it kind of protects Triple H, but I just don't understand Jericho and Undertaker's motivation.
Yeah, I think it protected Triple H. So based on the build, I think the logic they were going for is I'm guessing Jericho is attacking Hogan because he wants Triple H to win, because I think he feels then he'll get a rematch since they faced each other at WrestleMania. And I'm guessing Taker's logic is I want Hulk Hogan to win because he's the easier opponent. I can, you know, he's now the number one contender, so I want whoever's going to be easiest for me. So I kind of see in the storyline what the logic is, but I don't like it in the match so much because I think it just kind of muddied it up a little bit. And sort of, because if you think about the whole reasoning for this, like, you know, you're going for this nostalgia thing. You're going for the Hogan pop because the crowd's so behind him. And I feel like it took a little bit of wind out of that Hogan, out of the sails of the Hogan win, because you have all this kind of stuff coming in, you know, with Taker and all this interference. And then he kind of hits the leg drop. It muddies it up a little bit, and then everybody, you know, the crowd and everybody's a little focused on that. So I thought it would have been a little bit cleaner, and I guess they want to protect Triple H because he is kind of, you know, he is sort of taking one for the team here by having his title reign cut so short. So I guess they are protecting him, but I guess I'm just thinking about if you want to maximize this match in this moment, I think you would have been better off, you know, leaving that out. But so this match, I thought the first part of the match was a little bit slow, and I know they were going for like the, you know, test of strength kind of classic Hogan stuff. And I wasn't expecting this to be Rogan, if you want to put him together like I almost did, because they didn't quite, you know, they don't have the intangibles here, that it doesn't have the mystique of Rock and Hogan. It's not on the WrestleMania stage. So I get that they couldn't get to that level. But I thought maybe my thing with this match is I thought it was solid, especially considering, you know, Hogan is not, you know, he's not a miracle worker at this point. I thought it was still a solid match, but I think it could have been a little bit better if you, like, I don't want to dock it for not being what I wanted, and I don't think I am. Like, I went 2.5 on it, which I went right down the middle because I just thought it was a good, solid match. But I feel like if instead of, if you cut out the run-ins a little bit, if you just want to have a really good match between them, I feel like I would have done a little more focusing on what Triple H does with the knee and just come right out of the gate with that. Like, if you really just want to tell an awesome story in the match, I think it would be like, you know, Triple H as, you know, make him working the leg. Like, he knows he's going after an older guy who's not in the best shape, and he knows that, so he's just going to knock him down and, like, you know, take his legs out and kind of focus the match more on that. You probably could have had a better match, but all in all, it still was good. It was still a good moment. And, you know, like I said, it wasn't bad. I think they could have maybe been a little bit better, but I can't, you know, I'm not going to dock them for it. It was some, you know, it was fine. I wasn't expecting a classic, you know?
Yeah. And so I wound up with the same rating you did. I wound up with a 2.5. One thing that I think that I want to talk about, Eric, is I think Triple H put on a pretty damn good performance because I think he was in a really tough spot. And to some degree, the WWE had, or WWF at the time had kind of painted themselves into a corner because Triple H was this conquering babyface coming back at the Royal Rumble. And, you know, that was a few months ago, but, you know, he won the title at Mania and they don't want to give up on the Triple H babyface experiment. But when this match was still really face-to-face, it was really hurt, in my opinion. And the more that Triple H would heal it up, the better the match got. But he still had to play a subtle heel. You know, he would heal it up without turning heel. And, you know, JR mentions that, well, Triple H hasn't done anything illegal, which was true at the time. So he was playing up that story. And I thought that Triple H did a really good job against a very limited opponent, playing heel without turning heel, which was just a really tough spot. And I'm not a Triple H apologist. Shortly after this point, you're not. But in, you know, just rewatching this, I felt like that was the case. And this is one case where I really do wish I would have embraced this moment a little more. And partly I was expecting better things from Triple H, but I think that was something that the crowd that was there just to do that, I think they got a kind of a special moment out of that. So it probably would have been better had they not had all the bullshittery around it, but that was something they painted themselves into corners by having all these number one contenders and everything else, which I think had a lot of potential. I don't know what your thoughts are on having one champion traveling to both shows, but I think that had a lot of potential. And I think they just, that was one of those things they cut bait on too quick and didn't really fully explore.
Yeah. I'm interested to see, but I do like the traveling, the champion. But going back to the Logan thing, it's been the story of the feud. Like, since I started the pod and this kind of feud developed with Hogan and Triple H. And it's, I think that they did the best with the situation that they had. I mean, like, if I were to sit here and book my ideal feud for them, you know, I would want, you know, 2000 heel Triple H, like when he was feuding with Foley, like ruthless Triple H against this old dog, old babyface Hogan. Like, to me, that would be ideal. But I can't fault them because, you know, they had to pull out whatever they could. And I think that's part of the run-ins, too, is because, you know, Jericho and all, like, they've been in the feud because, like you said, because Hogan's, you know, because Triple H is not a heel, they've had to have a lot of intermediaries come in to sort of build the heat between them because they can't just have them go straight at each other because face-to-face. But I think they did the best with what they could work with on, you know, short notice, trying to improvise this since WrestleMania. But, you know, could it have been better in certain aspects? Probably so. But all in all, I think they did a pretty decent job with this whole, you know, Hulkamania resurrection angle with Triple H. And we'll see where it goes. Obviously, I don't think it's going to last super long, but I see why they did it. I don't blame them. But all right. Okay. So we will get into our overall thoughts and ratings for the show. So I definitely don't think this is a bad show. I would still consider this a good show, but I think given the build to it, the build was solid, and I don't quite feel like it was quite as good as I thought of it thought it could have been. And like we said, I think a lot of the undercard matches were really good, especially for undercard matches. And they clearly have an undercard established. Like, it's not a weakness by any chance. It's, I think, more of a strength at this point. But I think because a lot of them, the undercard matches kind of had that chapter one, you know, starting of a feud, sort of first match in a series vibe, I don't think that, you know, pushed this towards being some all-time show. And then obviously, like we talked about, Austin Taker is really, really drags it down because it's so long. It's in a marquee spot. It takes up so much time on the show. So that kind of hurts it. And also to me, the even though it didn't take a huge amount of time, the Hall match, and not just that it was a bad match, but just the him going over Bradshaw, I thought wasn't, you know, best. I thought it would have been a lot. It would have helped the show to have Bradshaw go over as a face. And, you know, the main event scene is a little wonky with, you know, Austin and Taker and all that. But like going in, I said the TV has been decent, but not great. And I think that's normally fine, but I think you want to pay it off at the big show a little bit better than what they did here. Like, you know, like I was thinking, you know, if I'm thinking of this as a payoff to the last month of TV, I thought it's been fine, but it could have been better. It's like, I feel like they were building, kind of saving some things for the pay-per-view that didn't quite come to fruition. It didn't quite accomplish it in every area. But so the end of my diatribe is I went 6 out of 10 on this, which I think is a little bit above average, is more good. But I kind of thought with the build, especially with some of those undercard matches, if they would have been a little bit better, I probably would have put this more a little bit higher. But still, I think it's a good show. Definitely not a bad show. The undercard holds it up, I think, for sure. And a Hogan moment. But what'd you think, Tyler? Sorry.
Yeah. I think that that's good logic. I went a 7 out of 10, so I was a little bit higher. I thought there were a lot of good matches. And I thought there was not a ton of significance, but there was the last Hogan title win and Brock's debut, which was an important moment as well. And as we talked about, I think that first chapter, you know, is that I think that does hurt it. You know, there was more to come with Edge and Angle, more to come with Eddie and RVD, and better in both cases, I think. So I'd have to go back and look at the Angle Edge feud, but I know that I prefer some of the RVD Eddie stuff that's still to come. The main event was just such a I don't even know, just like musical chairs at this point. And I know why they did it. I don't believe they were expecting the Hogan nostalgia tour and for him to get as over as he did, but for just a short period of time. So then you get this rotating world title bouncing around. And there's just not a lot of clarity at this moment in time for that. But yeah, you know, I think we're pretty close. I have 7 out of 10. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that extra point could easily be because I was there. So that's where
I'm at. I think if I was a little bit higher, like most are on the Angle Edge match, that would probably boost my rating a little bit. But again, I don't think it's, I guess my thing is it's like kind of in line, but like on the same level I've seen the TV, and I was almost expecting the pay-per-view to be a little bit on the next level. Like they were kind of building towards it and that some things were like the pay-per-view is going to be amped up a little bit, where I felt it was like, it's kind of stayed solid. Like the TV's been okay for the most part. There's been a few bad spots, and this was just a solid pay-per-view, but definitely not, you know, bad by any means, I wouldn't say. I don't think I think there's too much other good stuff on here. And the Hogan moment, even though it's not the greatest match, is still a good moment. I don't think that 30-minute Austin Taker match, it definitely hurts the show, but I don't think it's submarines. I think there's enough good, solid stuff on the before that to, you know, kind of even it out. But, all right, let's get to our awards.
I do think that part of this is just the product of it being a backlash, whereas a lot of things aren't meant to be paid off. They're meant to start new feuds, and I think this show definitely reflects that. I think that when Aaron and JT did their rankings of whatever the post-mania show. This was fifth or sixth or seventh, which seems about right to me. There hasn't been a ton of great stuff there, and this isn't slotted to that. So, and sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you. So, but I wanted to
you're fine.
At that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Like, I definitely think it's an overall satisfying, you know, conclusion to the TV that's built into it, and it's, you know, moving on. So it's been good. I can't say, you know, it's not like I got to this pay-per-view and I was like, this sucks compared, you know, they didn't pay anything off, you know. It was a logical pay-per-view for what they built to, which is fine. But, okay, so awards, best match. So I have, so kind of surprised myself, but I have Tajiri and Kidman as my best just overall match. You know, obviously probably not the most important match, but if I'm just going on pure match, I'm going to Jerry Kidman.
Well, I did like that match too, but I have Edge Angle.
Totally fine. I think most people would be in your camp. I think I'm in the minority with that one. But so best moment, I had the Hogan win. I think is kind of an easy one on this show.
Yeah, I think that's a no-brainer. And that was just a huge moment for the live crowd and you know, again, had I not been a little too full of myself or too up my own ass, I don't know what was going on then, but that happens sometimes when you're late 20s or mid 20s, or I don't know. Maybe it happens to me all the time. but definitely, Hogan's title was the moment of the night.
You're just worried about the snowflakes. You didn't care about that nostalgia shit.
That's right. This is important shit, you know?
So, LVP, this one, I think we have a few candidates. I went Hall just because I feel like, you know, it wasn't like some marquee spot, but he just looked really rough in that match. But I easily probably, I almost wanted to go Flair as the ref in that match, but I feel it's a little hard on him because he's not the, you know, there's other problems in that match. So I'm going to go with Hall just because he just doesn't. He doesn't even really look like he should be in the ring, honestly. It's sad. I mean, I'm not trying to shit on the guy, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, no, that's a good selection. And I didn't consider him very strongly, and not because he didn't suck and didn't, not because he brought any value, because he didn't, but just because it was a shorter match and not as high profile. I went Undertaker because he was in the worst match, and I thought he was a pretty strong contributor to it being the worst match, and he had the interference in the main event that didn't make sense to me. I considered both Flair and Austin because they were also in that bad match, and Flair's performance as a referee was significantly bad for the spotlight he had on him. You know, he shouldn't have been able to impact that match as much as he did. But at the end of the day, I did go Undertaker for the least valuable player. And I did watch the TV, as I mentioned before, because I remembered just not liking this era of Undertaker at all. But I thought he was pretty good in the buildup. Like you said, he was better than I remembered him being. But he wasn't better tonight, in my opinion.
Yeah, I can almost go Taker too, honestly. Yeah, I'm right there with you. I could easily switch to Taker, but so normally I do best show, but since this is a pay-per-view, that doesn't really apply because it's just one pay-per-view. It's still, they're all together. So I'm deciding kind of on the fly. So I normally do the top five and actually number them, but I think what I'm going to do is not, because I think I've drive myself crazy trying to rank these one to five. So this is what we'll do. Don't worry about, you know, which had number one, two, three, four, and five, just in no particular order. Let's just each name five, like five people who stood out in this card that we considered, you know, spotlights or who sort of like our MVPs of the show. I'll let you start, Tyler. What you got? And if you match, I'll tell you if I have somebody that matches you.
Okay. Well, I had them in order, but I'll just throw out Ed. Because I do think this was kind of his coming out party. I don't know that I ever thought of Edge as much of a singles wrestler before this point. But after this point, I think he had to at least consider him, you know, as at least a strong mid-carder.
Yeah, I have Edge too. I thought it was a good showing. He was put in a spot to elevate himself, and he definitely carried himself. So good showing for him. I had Tajiri because he was in my best match tonight, and I really thought he carried that match by getting himself over as a heel and getting Kidman some getting the crowd behind Kidman. So I thought Tajiri was awesome, especially in the opener.
I did not have him, but that is a great pick, and I'm glad you made it. I had Eddie Guerrero. Mm-hmm. Obviously, yep. His big comeback. Same. I thought he just really showed great fire and intensity. And I think he was spot on with his character getting over as a heel.
Yep. I have Eddie also. He's looked like a stud since he's come back for sure. Somebody else I had is I have Hogan just because I thought Hogan kind of overperformed. I mean, it wasn't anything spectacular. It wasn't going to make anybody's top 100 list, but I thought he came in and probably did more than he needed to and kind of carried himself. And I really liked his character work that he's been doing, and it came through in this show too. So I went Hogan.
Okay, and I had him, so we had matched there.
Gotcha.
The next one I had Brock Lesnar. I thought for a debut, I don't know that could have gone much better than it did. I thought he showed off his offense great. He showed that he had a little bit more clubs in the bag. I didn't bring him out a whole lot, but he just showed he could do it. So Brock Lesnar was next on my list.
Yeah, I didn't put Brock, but I easily could. You think there's only so many matches on here. There's only so many people on here, and you get five. And even with five, you're like, man, I feel like I'm leaving people off. But I didn't have Brock, but I easily could have. Another one I have on here is I actually put Jazz on here because I thought she kind of carried that match. I thought she really helped Trish, kind of similar to Tajiri. I mean, it wasn't like a super featured spot on the card, but I thought for the role that she was given, I thought she I think she's a good addition to the women's division. So I actually gave Jazz a little nod on my list.
Okay. So I didn't know this is the way we're going to go, so I didn't have this one on there, but I'll go ahead and throw Triple H on there because I do think that he made the best of a bad situation in a face-to-face match by being the subtle heel. And so I think he made what could have been kind of a bad situation better.
Yeah, I have Triple H on mine too. I think he, I think he did a good job. I think him and Hogan both did a good job. It's weird to sit here and like praise him so much for what is probably we both kind of put as sort of an average match, but it's a weird match to grade, because it's like expectations kind of play into it. And yeah, I think he did a good job kind of, working with Hogan and his limitations. So yeah, I had him too. So I think that was five for each of us. Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, okay, so I added Triple H, so that would give me six. So I had Kurt Angle, too, because he was in the match, and I thought he really drove that match.
There's a lot of good performances on this show, honestly. Like, a lot of people really showed up and played their roles and did what they were supposed to do. It's, I think, man, it makes you think of, even if Taker and Austin just come out and have, a 10-minute, standard brawl between them, I mean, it would really help the show. It's just, man, that match really, it hurts because it's just so fucking long. Ugh.
Give some of that time to Eddie and RVD. This feels like a show that with just a few tweaks could have been, if not an all-time classic, at least when you start talking about the best post-Mania shows, it's right near the top. And it just it didn't quite hit that level to me.
Yep. Totally agree. Solid, but nothing, nothing amazing. So, all right, Tyler. So that we have gotten through Backlash 2002. You have been an awesome guest. Tyler, is there anything you would like to plug at this time?
I mean, I don't do a ton of stuff on PTBN, but I have been helping with the top 100 GWWE matches, and we're doing the results of that. We are releasing every Friday, so not sure when this will drop, but we're getting down to a couple more releases, so look for that on Friday. And this is nothing that I really am doing other than participating in and have been really engaged in is the Knicks project for 2020 is the greatest WCW matches of all time. And I can't oversell how excited I am about this, how much I'm enjoying this. Just going back and watching 80s Crockett, I mean, it's just been amazing. And the dialogue on the Facebook page, if you're not on there, go on there. If you see people recommending matches or making matches available, watch them. You won't be disappointed. It's just been amazing, in my opinion, and I'm enjoying that more than I have even the previous projects that I've been engaged in and have really enjoyed. So,
yeah, I agree. I'm super into Ryan too, and I kind of agree with you because this might be my favorite one so far, just because I'm less familiar with, you know, NWA and WCW than I am with WWEF. So it's kind of a lot more discovering things, where I find that the WWE is more like, I'm kind of familiar with things, just kind of figure out where I stand on them, where a lot of this is, it's the WCW stuff is me discovering things for the first time, which is always super fun. But I totally agree with you. And you do awesome work putting that all together, sort of behind the scenes with the write-ups and everything. You do an awesome job on that.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. So for me, this is Ruthlessly Aggressive Podcast on the North South Connection podcast feed. We have tons of awesome shows coming out daily, pretty much, at least during the business week, Monday through Friday. So we have Wrestling War Zone, which they just dropped a really awesome episode on WrestleMania 12, their two WrestleMania, which is amazing to think about where they started. But really awesome. I mean, probably their best episode yet. Really awesome stuff. Extreme Three-Way Dance going through ECW. Carolina Dreamin' is where Chad, like how Tyler just mentioned, like 80s Crockett and WCW, NWA, what have you. That's Chad's pod where he's kind of going through that stuff. Chad also has Fighting Spirit of 06, where he's going through the year of 2006, which is a very interesting year for all of wrestling. Jeff Learns Wrestling, which is a very popular show where Jeff goes through and pretty much has no knowledge of wrestling going in. So he's kind of experiencing all for the first time. No Holds Bar, where JT and Aaron sort of do different, mostly ranking things. They're ranking, like Tyler mentioned, the pay-per-views for each month and that sort of thing. And sometimes they even bring up stuff from Aaron's podcast, which is The Year That Was, where he watched every single pay-per-view in WWE history and then sort of ranked the years from best to worst and that sort of thing. It's a really fun. It's one of my favorite podcasts to listen to right now. Aaron's always entertaining. But yeah, tons of great stuff. If you want to follow me on Twitter, my Twitter is Jambalaya_Jake. Thanks Tyler for coming on. You're a great guest. If you would have told me this was your first podcast, you could have fooled me.
Well, thank you. You're too kind, and you were a very, very gentle first podcast experience, Jacob. I appreciate
it. Yeah, I tried to handle like Triple H, trying to move Hogan through this match without breaking his hip. So.
Yeah, well, I didn't break a hip, so.
Awesome. Well, this has been another edition of the Ruthlessly Aggressive Podcast, and join me next episode for some more Ruthless Aggression. Bye-bye.
Hold the charm for you. You can't concern yourself with bigger things. You catch a pull and ride the dragon's wings. Cause it's the heat of the moment. The heat of the moment. The heat of the moment. Showed in your eyes.
up were the things you wanted for yourself. Teenage ambitions you'll remember.